Good morning, everyone. Thank you for coming on the morning after a historic evening. Today, we're going to focus on international research. And we have three talks that will provide different perspectives on important, but some of them controversial, issues in the conduct of international research. You will certainly see some overlap in some of the topics that we've covered already, but the attention given today will be how do the particular things that we've talked about in some of the other sessions apply to the particulars of conducting research internationally. So our first speaker, who you met last week, is Seema Shah, who is an attorney in the Department of Bioethics here at the Clinical Center and also with the Henry Jackson Foundation and the Division of AIDS at NIAID. And she's going to present International Research Ethics and Overview. Before I turn it over to her, I would like to remind you that if you haven't signed in, please sign in and remember your evaluations and your forms for how many hours you've been here today. Thanks.
Hi, everyone. It's a pleasure to be here before you again today, although I feel like so much has happened since we last talked. I know that many of you might be tired or still trying to process what happened last night in this history-making day, but I hope that we can direct your attention to some really controversial and interesting issues in international research ethics. What I would like to do today is to provide you with some of the considerations, an overview of the considerations that are relevant to international research ethics. And along the way, you'll see that many of them are quite controversial. So I'll try to point out some of the problems that people have noted with them. What you'll also realize is that as I provide you with criticisms, the application of all of these considerations is simply not straightforward. It's not that there's a formula or a bunch of checkboxes that you can just tick off. It's that there are a bunch of relevant considerations that people have thought about over the years, and many of these will apply differently in different cases. So as the day goes on, Alan Wertheimer will talk to you a little bit more about the concept of exploitation. And then Ryder Lee will talk about some specific cases. Sounds exciting out there. Some specific cases that will deal with some of the concepts that I've introduced. So let's get started. First, let me just say that the opinions I express today are my own and not the opinions of anyone else in the U.S. government or the Henry Jackson Foundation. So in general, multinational research is essential to understanding and ultimately controlling diseases that are of global importance, but it necessarily involves many complex ethical issues. Typically, what we're thinking about here is a research study that involves at least two countries. So there could be a sponsor country that pays and a research country that hosts the research. Or it could be that research is conducted in multiple sites around the world. Why is it that people do multinational research? Well, there are a number of reasons. One would be to study diseases that are more prevalent in a host country. So if you wanted to do HIV prevention research, it might be difficult to do in developed countries where the infection rates are fairly low. What you need to do is prove a difference between the control arm and the intervention arm. And the way that people typically do that is in the rate of infections. So you have to have a high enough rate of infections to do your research at all. It may also be that there are health problems that exist only in the host country, such as malaria or sleeping sickness, which makes it difficult to do your research in a developed country. It may be that research is done in developing countries because more participants are available or because it's less expensive to do the research in another country. And I think this leads us to one of the broader ways that people think about this. What are the ethical implications of outsourcing? Outsourcing is becoming increasingly common in many different industries. So one of the more interesting examples I've heard of recently is that Hollywood is increasingly outsourcing its productions, filming TV series in countries like Colombia, where the actors, the directors, the script supervisors are all from the U.S., but everybody else involved is from Colombia to be able to obtain cheaper labor. And some of the considerations that might be relevant there maybe are also relevant in research. But it seems like people have thought about research and outsourcing very carefully and have paid a lot of attention to that. And it's not clear how the distinction between how we treat general outsourcing and research outsourcing should really be. But what I'd like to talk about today, and with the example I'd like you to carry through some of the concepts that I talk about, is a trial of an expensive blood pressure medication that would be conducted in India, tested against a placebo, but the company does not intend to market the drug anywhere except the United States. So this is an example of a trial that could be conducted in India, and the questions that I raise will be questions that are relevant to this and many other types of international research. The general concerns that people tend to have when they think about international research is the exploitation of vulnerable populations. What you often actually hear is that people claim that everyone in a developing country is vulnerable. And I think this claim is far overstated. For instance, as Christine Grady showed you last week, when you look at the data on informed consent, there is not a clear difference between the level of understanding in developing countries versus developed countries. It's just that many research participants have trouble with the same difficult concepts, no matter where they are. It also, I think, dilutes the concept of vulnerability to suggest that everyone in a developing country would be vulnerable. There are vulnerable populations, such as children, within a developing country that you might want to separate out and treat differently. So I think it's important to be careful about the use of this term and to think carefully about what research in a developing country really means. But what people worry about, I think, is power differentials, that it may be hard for developing countries to negotiate with more powerful, wealthier, and more knowledgeable parties. And so this may lead to unfair advantage. Some people are also concerned that there might be a lack of capacity to review research. What's interesting about this is that many places, including the Department of Bioethics here, have dealt with this issue by trying to build capacity in review of research and considerations of research ethics in developing countries. So this has been an ongoing effort for a number of years. There are also language, cultural, and educational barriers. There's a context of historical justice where many people think that developing countries are in the situation they're in because of the unfair advantage that some developed countries have taken from them in the past. And there also is some ongoing current injustice. The main current injustice that people talk about related to research is often referred to as the 10-90 gap. The idea here is that 90% of global funds for research related to healthcare are spent on only 10% of the global disease burden. And research on many important diseases that disproportionately affect developing countries is neglected. Some, seeking to address this problem, try to put ethical limits on the research that can be conducted in developing countries to better or worse effect. But this is one of the things that really underlies many of the concepts I'll discuss. So to give you a sense of what we'll be talking about today, I split up the ideas, the concepts that are relevant in international research ethics by obligations to individuals and obligations to communities. Within obligations to individuals, we'll think through issues that arise during the trial, like standard of care and ancillary care, and then move on to issues that come up after the trial, what types of post-trial obligations investigators might have to the subjects in their research. Next, we'll think through obligations to communities. And the issues that come up here are called responsiveness to health needs, reasonable availability of the trial intervention, and a challenge to reasonable availability, an alternative, the fair benefits framework. And I'll discuss these concepts at greater length. So obligations to individual subjects typically come up during the trial and after the trial. During the trial, the issues that arise are, what's the standard of care? Can you use placebos? And also, what type of ancillary care should investigators provide? So what comes up in the question of standard of care is, what is it that you test a new intervention in comparison to during the trial? And you have a variety of options. You could use placebo. You could use what is locally available to most people in the country where you're operating. You could use what is locally available to a select few or some of the people. And you could also test your intervention against the best drugs in the world. So this question of what it is you test against your intervention has led to a great deal of controversy. I think one of the important distinctions to make that people don't always make is that there's a difference between the standard of care as what clinicians think is best and a standard of care that has a solid evidence base. So people often tend to be loose in talking about these two types of standards of care. But I think if it's the standard of care where clinicians tend to think that this is the best thing that should be offered to subjects, there still may be important reasons to conduct research on that particular standard of care. For example, the very famous example of how 41,000 patients underwent high-dose chemotherapy and autologous bone marrow transplant over a number of years, after which at least five major randomized controlled trials showed no advantage of this riskier alternative to the alternative lower-dose chemotherapy. So this, I think, taught us an important lesson that we do need to prove that the standard of care is the appropriate standard of care. There are a number of guidelines that talk about standard of care. The World Medical Association's Declaration of Helsinki in 2008, which just came out pretty much last week, contains this statement: the benefits, risks, and burdens and effectiveness of a new intervention must be tested against those of the best current proven intervention, with two exceptions. So they say that in general you need to test it against the best intervention that's been proven. But if there is no current proven intervention, then clearly that that obligation wouldn't apply. But they also allow for a change where, for compelling and scientifically sound methodological reasons, the use of placebo is necessary and poses no risks of serious or irreversible harm. So they lay out this option, but they also say that extreme care must be taken to avoid abusing this option. There are other approaches that have been taken. Other policies require scientific justification for the trial design, but they may require something less than the best proven standard of care. So the UK's Nuffield Council has this requirement, that the standard of care that the country endeavors to provide nationally should be what you test your intervention against. UNAIDS requires it's the highest level of care that's obtainable in the host country, which may mean that only a select few are able to obtain it, but that's the standard you would use in your trial. And the National Bioethics Advisory Commission recommended that the risks and benefits to subjects be reasonably balanced and the risks minimized, but didn't specify more than that for the standard of care. So that's all I'll say about standard of care. Ryder-Lee will discuss a particular case with regard and raise some of the really interesting issues here. The next thing I'd like to talk about is ancillary care. So ancillary care is treatment that is provided to study participants that is not part of the design of the study. The idea is that sometimes you identify conditions that need treatment during screening or study visits, and you might provide care to your subjects because they're there before you, or for other reasons. So one example of this is that if subjects get research MRIs that reveal incidental findings, and either those findings are communicated to subjects or those findings are subjects are referred to treatment or provided with treatment, that would be an example of providing ancillary care. There aren't many guidelines about what kinds of obligations ancillary care will generate. The Council for International Organizations of the Medical Sciences, CIOMS, says that although sponsors are, in general, not obliged to provide healthcare services beyond that which is necessary to conduct research, it is morally praiseworthy to do so. So the idea here is that there's not an obligation to provide ancillary care, but it would be a good thing to do. In practice, however, even though there isn't a clear obligation, many researchers do, in fact, provide ancillary care, and the issue is far from settled. One thing that can help us think about this is a framework that was developed by Belsky and Richardson, and they attempted to derive something called, they used an entrustment model and derived a limited obligation about ancillary care. Their ideas here were that the analogy was to, let's say you were driving your car and you parked it in a parking garage overnight. If you were to park your car in the parking garage, the people who own the parking garage might have certain obligations to you, certain limited obligations, because they're in charge of your property. You've entrusted it to them for a certain period of time. But those obligations aren't the same as, say, fiduciary obligations that might arise, or more careful obligations from a more intensive relationship. So the idea was that distinguishing these types of models might give you a better sense of what ancillary care obligations might arise. What they noted was that in some cases, researchers may just be obligated to provide information to subjects and refer them to other places to get treatment. But there are other factors that affect whether and how much ancillary care should be provided. And the factors that they laid out include how much permission to perform the interventions has to be granted by the subject, the nature of the study, what the risks and benefits are in particular, the confidential nature of the information that's revealed to the investigator, and the length of time that the subject is involved in the study. So this was, I think, the first and most interesting framework that's been developed to think through what ancillary care obligations might be, but it certainly hasn't settled the matter, and this is still a very open and live question. So what are the obligations that arise after the trial is over? Well, after the trial, people are concerned that because researchers develop relationships with subjects who take on risks to contribute to generalizable knowledge, it's not the case that when the research comes to an end, the participant's need for treatment also ends. So researchers may be in a position where they don't want to abandon study participants altogether, or they don't want to make those study participants worse off after the research is over. The worry is that potential research subjects are in great need and vulnerable to exploitation. They may not be able to get a fair share of benefits from their research participation. And this has led to considerations about what obligations might exist after the trial. But one of the things that's important to keep in mind is that research subjects in developing countries may be in positions where there are others who owe them obligations as well. There might be international aid organizations working in the country, or the government might have obligations to these subjects. So it's not just that the researchers are there and carry this obligation. Sometimes I think it's important to think about the role of other parties. So what do the guidelines say about post-trial access for individuals in research? The Declaration of Helsinki in 2000 issued this statement. At the conclusion of the study, every patient entered into the study should be assured of access to the best proven prophylactic, diagnostic, and therapeutic methods identified by that study. This was an incredibly strong statement. When they made this statement, it came under a lot of fire because people were worried that this meant that researchers had incredible obligations to provide care for subjects in research. And it, many people worried it might make it difficult to conduct research in very resource-poor settings at all. So in 2008, the Declaration of Helsinki revised this statement in an interesting way. Now the statement reads, at the conclusion of the study, patients entered into the study are entitled to be informed about the outcome of the study and to share any benefits that result for it. For example, access to interventions identified as beneficial in the study or to other appropriate care or benefits. So you see that this statement is a lot softer than the previous statement. It suggests that patients have some entitlement to, research subjects have some entitlement to information about the outcome of the study and to share some benefits. But those benefits are defined much more loosely than the best proven intervention that came out of that particular trial. And I think this really emerged in response to a lot of controversy that arose as a result of the Declaration of Helsinki's 2000 statement. There are other statements on post-trial access. The National Bioethics Advisory Commission has noted that researchers and sponsors in clinical trials should make reasonable, good faith efforts before the initiation of a trial to secure, at its conclusion, continued access for all participants to needed experimental interventions that have been proven effective for the participants. And this language is a little bit stronger than where the Declaration of Helsinki has gone to now, but what it does, I think, as it suggests that researchers and sponsors are just required to make efforts to secure this care, not that they're required to provide the care themselves. They also noted that research protocols should typically describe the duration, extent, and financing of such continued access, that the results of the trial are relevant. So clearly, if the trial showed that the intervention was not effective, you wouldn't have a post-trial obligation to provide it. And the NBAC noted that if no arrangements were made, it's not the case that the research is presumptively unethical. The idea is that the researcher would have to justify to the Ethics Review Committee why there were no arrangements made. So these guidelines, I think, are somewhat helpful, but they don't distinguish some of the important and difficult questions that arise with post-trial access. So One question is, should we handle acute and chronic conditions differently? When you think about acute versus chronic conditions, if you have an acute condition, you may need to only provide a short-term intervention. So if you had a malaria vaccine that was provided to an interventional group but not to a control group, if you were required to provide the effective malaria vaccine to the control group, this may not be a very large or very intensive obligation. But for chronic conditions, the calculus changes quite a bit. If it's the case that researchers are obligated to provide access to antiretroviral therapy for people suffering from HIV and AIDS for the rest of the participants' lives, that's a very different kind of obligation, a very intensive obligation. So it seems like the guidelines should distinguish between these two types of situations. And the guidelines, as a result, provide very little guidance regarding long-term, resource-intensive post-trial obligations. They also fail to address the uncertainty that's inherent in post-trial planning. It may be the case that funding sources change, that there are political changes in a country, or there are related scientific developments. So the thing that was proven effective in a particular trial might be something that is much less effective than other things that were proven later. And I think maybe the problem is that it's just difficult to capture the issue of uncertainty. And the only way that guidelines can really do that is to be somewhat flexible, to allow for some other source to review the plans and determine whether the plans are sufficient given the fact of uncertainty. It's also true that even if there was provision to a host country system for treatment, even if it was the case that researchers are supposed to refer their subjects to another source for treatment, the system may not be prepared for it. So it may be that a system is not able to provide the same standard of care that was available in the trial, or a system may become overwhelmed. If there's a very large study that finishes and many people all of a sudden need care through their local systems. I think one other important question that arises, and one of the things that's always at the back of people's minds, is whether these guidelines could create a disincentive to do research in very resource-poor settings. If it's the case that investigators have very intensive post-trial obligations that they need to secure access for the long term to the people involved in particular trials, it may be not ideal to go to a place where there are no existing mechanisms to provide people with care. So this is one worry that many people have. You might ask, now that we've thought through with a guideline, say, how is it that post-trial obligations play out in practice? Well, the NIH has a guidance document in which it recommends that investigators and contractors work with host countries' authorities and other stakeholders to identify available sources of antiretroviral treatment. So this policy exists for developing countries, and the idea is that if you conduct an antiretroviral treatment trial, you have to think through what will happen after the trial for your subjects. The plans for post-trial access that are developed by investigators can then be taken into account during funding decisions. So Christine Grady, Stacey Elmer from the University of Kansas, and I conducted a study on the NIH guidance on post-trial access for antiretroviral treatment trials, and I'll just show you some of our results. We found 18 studies conducted from July 2005 to July 2007, and most of the plans didn't guarantee access, but instead referred subjects to existing structures. They referred subjects to local governments, the President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, the Global Fund, or sometimes employer plans. There were some unusual steps that some took. One investigator planned to solicit charitable donations to try and provide access to his subjects. Another plan guaranteed transitional access for the 2 or 3 months they thought it would take subjects to get going on the nationwide program. So what can we learn from this study of post-trial access for HIV, AIDS, antiretroviral trials in developing countries? And how can we extrapolate this to other types of trials? I think what's difficult to figure out is, the fact is that it's more challenging in some respects to think about the question of HIV and AIDS. It requires thinking through expensive, lifelong, and potentially life-saving treatment in contexts that may lack the necessary infrastructure. But there are an increasing number of healthcare mechanisms available to provide this care for people in many countries around the world, which makes this question a little bit easier to deal with. So researchers in our study could partner with existing programs, could find ways to transition their subjects to existing programs. But if you wanted to think through how you might provide someone with diabetes treatment in Rwanda after the course of a trial, that would be a more difficult question to answer. It is still true that treatment of acute illness or prevention modalities may be more feasible because the obligations will be more limited in scope and time. So now that we've thought through some of the obligations that exist for individuals, what are the obligations that researchers might have to communities? And you'll remember last week we spoke a bit about community consultation, so I won't revisit that discussion, but we'll think through some of the obligations that have been raised by various guidance documents. So most of these types of issues come up with what a researcher owes a community after the trial is over. Many have expressed concerns that research in developing countries may involve exploitation by developed countries who take unfair advantage of developing countries. So as a consequence, some ethics guidelines focus on the benefits to the host community. There are two related protections that have, I think, a variety of justifications, but one of the most prominent is that they are designed to prevent exploitation of communities. And these are the responsiveness of the research question to the health needs in the host country, or the reasonable availability of a successful intervention in a host country after the trial is over. So responsiveness to health needs addresses what the research question is and how it fits in with the needs and priorities of the country. SEOMS indicates that before undertaking research in a population with limited resources, the sponsor and the investigator must make every effort to ensure that the research is responsive to the health needs and the priorities of the population or community in which it is to be carried out. The Declaration of Helsinki, again, the most recent version, states that medical research involving a disadvantaged or vulnerable population or community is only justified if the research is responsive to the health needs and priorities of this population or community. So looking, one important thing to distinguish here is who the target population is. You see, SEOMS refers to research in a population with limited resources, and many of the guidance notes that in SEOMS refer to the question of how to conduct research in developing countries or communities within developing countries. But the Declaration of Helsinki goes a little bit further. It notes that research involving a disadvantaged or vulnerable population or community is its target. So this may extend, I'm not sure yet because it's so new, but this may even extend to populations within the U.S. or other developed countries. And this type of obligation then may be broader than the ones we've seen in the past. So what does it mean for a study to be responsive, you might ask? Responsive research is likely to include something like studying HIV, or AIDS, or malaria, or tuberculosis in sub-Saharan Africa, a disease that has a high disease burden in a country. But what is it that would be unresponsive then? It's hard to imagine going to a place to conduct research on a disease if the disease doesn't exist there at all. So when is it that research on a disease that exists in a place could still be unresponsive? There are very few examples in the literature about this. The Nuffield Council says provides one of the few examples. They say that further justification is needed to conduct research on Burkitt's lymphoma, which is a cancer that's endemic to Kenya and Uganda. It accounts for half of all childhood cancers in Africa, and there are almost no cases in developed countries. But it poses a much lower disease burden than HIV, AIDS, malaria, and tuberculosis. So the claim here is that because it has such a lower incidence rate and it affects so many fewer people, research on Burkitt's lymphoma is not as well justified as research on a disease that is much more prevalent and that has a higher disease burden for the country. But I think there are some important criticisms to think through about the responsiveness requirement, and I'll mention them briefly and then let you engage with this requirement more when Ridar Lee speaks to you a little bit later. One problem with the responsiveness requirement is that there is a lack of data on what kinds of research are being conducted in developing countries, and there isn't really a way to know if this is the best policy, if prohibiting unresponsive research is the best way to conduct research in developing countries, or if other more flexible versions of a responsiveness requirement would be better. It also may lead to undesirable outcomes for developing countries in particular cases. Most of the versions of the responsiveness requirement merely prohibit unresponsive research. And what we need to do, based on the concerns raised by the 1090 report, is to generate research options that study the neglected diseases that have been understudied. So in the meantime, if there are no other options, it appears that the responsiveness requirement suggests that a developing country shouldn't permit any research if all the research they have before them is considered unresponsive. And it's not clear that this is always the right outcome. Some people also may think that developing countries have good reason to conduct research that is not responsive to their health needs in particular cases. So there may be a policy choice to decide to do a trial to build capacity. And this, I think, is something that Ryder Lee will discuss further, so I'll leave you with a little tease there. Now I'd like to talk about reasonable availability. Reasonable availability is the idea that the product developed has to be made available to the country after the trial. So SEAMS phrases it in this way. As a general rule, the sponsoring agency should ensure that, at the completion of successful testing, any product developed will be made reasonably available to the inhabitants of the underdeveloped community in which the research was carried out. The Declaration of Helsinki, in the most recent version, notes that medical research involving a disadvantaged or vulnerable population or community is only justified if there is a reasonable likelihood that this population or community stands to benefit from the results of the research. And what's interesting here is the reason I have ellipses in this quote is that the first part of it relates to responsiveness. So the Declaration of Helsinki sees responsiveness and reasonable availability as linked. Some of the challenges that have arisen when we think about reasonable availability is who is it that the community is? What's the community that needs to receive access? If you conduct research in a particular set of subjects, and one of those set of subjects is the control group, is that the community you need to engage with? Or is it the village in which your research is conducted? Or the geographic region of the country? Or is it the entire country or the entire geographic region of the continent? The question of community hasn't been clearly specified. And as you saw, all of the different guidance documents use slightly different phrasing on what the community is. So I think one of the challenges is, how do you apply reasonable availability without really knowing who your target is? Another problem is that it takes a very narrow view of benefits. So the idea is that the trial that you conduct produces a particular proven intervention or not. And that's the type of benefit you need to ensure for your subjects. Other types of benefits may not be as important. It also is true that the reasonable availability requirement isn't applicable to a lot of research. So phase one trials don't necessarily result with the proven intervention. Further testing is needed before the intervention can be proven. So reasonable availability suggests that there's not a clear obligation to worry about providing your intervention if you conduct a phase one trial in a particular community. Another issue is that observational studies or other types of research where there isn't an intervention to be tested simply don't fall under the question of reasonable availability. One alternative that was developed because of the many criticisms that can be levied against reasonable availability is the fair benefits framework. So under the fair benefits framework, all potential benefits and risks of a trial would need to be evaluated, both to research participants and to communities, before and after the trial. The idea behind the fair benefits framework is that it's important to improve the community risk-benefit ratio through community involvement. So the community is consulted and involved at all levels of decision-making in an uncoerced fashion. And there is transparency in the decision-making so that communities can be aware of other types of deals that are entered into in different research contexts. The idea is that increased transparency will make the agreements that are reached more fair. The fair benefits framework has been criticized for requiring too little of researchers. Some people think that simply allowing a negotiation to occur between a community and a researcher might lead to unfair outcomes. And one of the reasons that they suggest that is that there are other factors that might influence the distributive fairness of an outcome. So there may be disproportionately weak bargaining power of developing countries and a lack of available alternatives, which makes it difficult for them to ask for a fair share of the benefits from the research. One of the ways to think about the fair benefits framework that may address some of these criticisms is that it may be helpful to supplement the framework with attempts to build the bargaining power of developing countries. And it's also important to remember that the fair benefits framework was intended to get away from the narrower view of reasonable availability. There are many types of benefits from research that can be available, and the fair benefits framework tries to take account of those types of benefits. If you're interested to read more about that, I provided a citation at the bottom of this slide. So what does all of this mean for our outsourcing example? What are the ethical considerations that arise for the trial of expensive blood pressure medication in India? So the first question, there are a set of questions, really, that you might ask yourself. And again, I'd like to emphasize that it's not that you can simply check off all of these boxes. It's that a careful consideration needs to be engaged in about all of these issues. And there are important considerations to think about and answers that can be reached, more and less justifiable options. But it's not the case that I can give you all of those answers in a short way for you to then take them out into the world. So the first issue that might come up is, what is the standard of care that you're going to test this expensive blood pressure medication against? And this would depend on what the standard of care is in India for blood pressure medications, what the standard of care is in the U.S. or in other developed countries for blood pressure medications, and also what the risks and benefits are of providing certain subjects with placebos. But I'll leave this for RIDAR to discuss at greater length. The next issue that might come up is ancillary care. So if an investigator is conducting a trial of an expensive blood pressure medication, they may begin the trial by measuring the blood pressure of the subjects who are involved. They may even have exclusion criteria for people who have dangerously high blood pressure. But what do they then do with that set of subjects? Do they owe them at least the information that their blood pressure has reached a certain, has exceeded a certain threshold for which they may need care? Or do they actually need to find a way to help those people get care? Those, I think, are challenging questions that will arise. And as the study goes on, there may be other types of depending on how long the study is and the type of involvement that subjects have with researchers, there may be other types of conditions that will come up. So one of the important ways to think about ancillary care is that it's important to anticipate what issues may arise in the future throughout the course of the trial, what types of procedures will be conducted that may lead to particular research findings or incidental findings, and then develop a plan to manage whatever it is that will come out of the research. Another question that may arise is post-trial access. If the expensive blood pressure medication is something that works in a particular set of subjects, would post-trial access be something that the researchers should provide to the subjects in the intervention arm or the subjects in the control arm? And if so, for how long? Expensive blood pressure medication might be something that people would have to take for the rest of their lives. So post-trial access obligations here could become very complicated if researchers had the obligation to provide the drugs themselves. The next issue that may come up is the question of responsiveness. Is it the case that doing a trial on a blood pressure medication is responsive in a developing country? Well, India is a mid-tier developing country, so it has a different character than other developing countries. And cardiovascular disease is becoming increasingly prevalent all around the world. So it's not immediately clear whether studying something like blood pressure is responsive in a particular context. My guess, without looking at the data, is that this would be a potentially responsive study in India. But it does depend on the prevalence of blood pressure problems in a country like India. Another question that may arise then is, what about reasonable availability? Well, here I think the trial may run into a problem. If you have a very expensive blood pressure medication and you need to make that available to people in a country like India, perhaps many people wouldn't be able to afford it. And if the company has no plans to license the drug in that country, then people simply wouldn't be able to access it. But this may also change when you have a country that has disparities. There may be broad income disparities between some parts of the population and others. So some people may have the ability to get access to a particular intervention and others may not. And unfortunately, reasonable availability doesn't really say anything about that possibility. Finally, the fair benefits framework is another approach or another consideration that would come up in a trial like this. And what would happen with the fair benefits framework is if researchers were planning to conduct research in India on this expensive blood pressure medication, they would have to negotiate with the relevant community and determine whether the package of risks and benefits for the community is fair and appropriate. And I think having that kind of approach and transparency in decision making is, at the outset, indeterminate. It's more of a process than it is a substantive criticism or approval of a particular study. But the fair benefits framework doesn't say from the outset whether this trial is unethical. It just suggests that a process would be needed before the trial could be ethical. So I think I'd also like to talk through a couple more issues with the consequences of community obligations. As we think through all of these obligations, it seems like there are a greater number of obligations that have been applied to researchers over the years. And the greater the obligations are to interact with communities, the more time researchers must then invest in community engagement. The more time that researchers spend with a particular community, the more that they're vulnerable to challenges of creating an over-researched community. And you might ask, what does this term mean, over-researched? This is a term that's been used in the past few years, although less frequently of late. And the claim is that if researchers engage with a particular community, one of the most famous examples is the community of Rakai, Uganda, and spend a great deal of time in that particular community, there may be harms that result to the community. One harm is that you may get skewed scientific data. So if most of your data comes from a particular community, then the data may have particular ways in which it's skewed and cannot be extrapolated to other communities. Another problem that people raise is that the benefits of research do not go to other communities. But I think the major concern people have is that burdens are unfairly borne by the over-researched community. Many people raise this concern in South Africa, where there have been a series of vaccine and microbicide trials in which subjects have been warned that they may have a higher risk of HIV infection because of the trial interventions, although the scientific data on this is difficult to sort through and so far has been somewhat inconclusive. So many people are worried that if this kind of research happens in a particular community over time, there are a great number of risks that that community is exposed to. There are also some important benefits of over-researched communities that I think people overlook when they use this term. One issue is that the community in Rakai, Uganda, when they were asked about their involvement in research, described it as overwhelmingly positive. And I think through true community engagement, researchers can help a community based on what they really need. So in the community of Vulindlela, South Africa, which is a very poor community, the researchers went to this community to do HIV prevention research, knowing that the young girls in this community had an HIV infection rate of between 25 and 30%. When they went to this community, they started to engage with the community and discuss with them the various aspects of the research. But as they did this, they found that the community members had a different sort of concern. What they were really worried about was their problem with orphans. Because so many people in this community were dying from HIV and AIDS, there were many young children who were left abandoned, who didn't have any parents or any way for someone to take care of them. And the resources of the community were being stretched thin because grandmothers were required to take care of multiple children at once. Or other children simply had no one to care for them. The community came to the researchers and said that this was a problem for them and one of the more pressing problems that they faced. And the researchers thought, this isn't something that we have particular expertise on. This isn't something we know what to do with, how to tell this community to deal with. So what they did was they contacted an investigator in the U.S. who was working on the structure of institutions for caring for orphans and different systems that could be developed. And that researcher applied for a grant and came to Bulin Leila over the course of a summer to help the people in this community set up a system for dealing with their orphan problem, for finding a way to care for all of these young children. What is interesting about this is this kind of community engagement can only happen, this kind of responsiveness to a community's broader needs can only happen when researchers spend a good deal of time in a particular community. So I think the charge of calling a community an over-researched community can be dangerous when it overlooks the fact that in order to responsibly engage with communities and to deal with the many obligations that I've laid out here, researchers often need to spend a great deal of time in a particular place. So in conclusion, ethical considerations regarding research in the developing world operate in contexts with complex political, cultural, and practical dimensions. And I haven't provided you with any easy answers today, but it is critical to think carefully about the study design, the benefits and burdens for research subjects, and community participation in developing and evaluating research. Thank you. Do you have any questions?
Since almost all research papers with therapeutic questions end up being positive, i.e., if they get in print, they've proved the utility of the drug, when does the researcher have the obligation to provide it? After an agency like our FDA says, okay, we believe not just this paper but 10 others, or is it the equivalent of the FDA in the country in which the research was done? Or are researchers just going to be allowed to run wild with their own conclusions about efficacy of their drug interventions?
Mm-hmm. So your question is, if you have all these different standards for efficacy, how do you determine when researchers have obligations to provide an efficacious drug?
Well, the opposite. You know, the obligation is there to provide it after the trial, but who decides it's the efficacious drug? Just that one study, or does it await regulatory body decisions? And then because it's international, are these bodies to be, I mean, I'm not even aware of an international drug approval body, for example.
So many countries have different licensing bodies or regulatory bodies. What's interesting is that quite a few countries, I think even including Brazil and South Africa, don't have licensing for medical devices at all. So those are simply unapproved in the country and can be used without any sort of regulatory background. So there are many different standards around the world. In general, one of the things that's difficult about conducting research in developing countries is that researchers may not be interested in licensing a drug in a particular place. It may be expensive to interact with that regulatory body. So some of the obligations here don't address that issue. What kinds of obligations researchers might have to license the drug in a particular place where they conducted research. I think in issues surrounding HIV, AIDS, and a bunch of other diseases, there are also international governmental organizations that are working on licensing and regulatory approvals so that when drugs are proven efficacious, they are able to be used in those countries. But there are a variety of standards. The legal situation is quite complex. And I think researchers are struggling a bit because the guidelines certainly don't address that or grapple with that at all. Wow, I must have done.
I have one other, which is more of a philosophical question. But these international regulations, I must say, strike me as still having a great deal of Western European colonialism and socialism language in them. I mean, if we just take the concept of community, in the U.S. 25 years ago, if we said, well, we're only going to do research on those diseases that are most prevalent in the U.S. population and lethal, we would have limited ourselves to cardiovascular disease and cancer. HIV/AIDS came along, the research wasn't organized in geographic communities or villages or anything of that nature. The community formed out of the individuals who were infected by these retroviruses. They formed a political community that forced action at the federal level. So I don't quite get how people in Western Europe and the United States and so on can write these things in a language that still suggests the form of paternalism in terms of the way this ought to be done in developing countries. It bothers me a great deal.
Yeah. So it is true that many of these guidelines have a somewhat paternalistic cast. It is difficult to create guidelines like these. So many organizations like SEAMS have tried to engage with members from developing countries and to get people on board so that the guidelines aren't just coming from the West and, you know, being applied to people in developing countries. But I think they've had somewhat limited success at that. It's been a challenge. One of the things that I think I mentioned earlier is that there are many groups that try and do training of people in developing countries in order to ensure that the conversations that happen don't just originate from the West, that people in developing countries can also participate. But in the talks I've given internationally on these types of issues, people do really talk about the importance of community. So in a sense, I think these guidelines may be reflecting or attempting to respond to a concern that is raised by many people in developing countries, that the U.S. is very individualistic, that we think of people as coming just by themselves, not surrounded by communities, not having a particular context that really matters when you engage with them. So the attempts that people have made have looked like what you saw up in my slides, and I think they are clearly imperfect. But it's not just that there are paternalistic guidelines that originate from developed countries. It's also the case that they're an attempt to engage with people from developing countries and to involve the concerns that some of those people have raised. And they're a very imperfect attempt to do that.
This is a question for both you and for Christine. Do the GCP guidelines address at all the issue of ancillary care? Do guidelines of good clinical practice have any implications for ancillary care? And then if not, is it within the purview of an IRB to accept or reject a study based on consideration of ancillary care, or can the researcher come back to the IRB saying that, you know, they're making demands on us regarding ancillary care, you're extending the bounds of your authority?
I am not familiar with any GCP guidelines on ancillary care. Maybe, Christine, you're familiar with that. To answer your second question, I think that many research ethics committees in developing countries are starting to also think about the issue of ancillary care. And some of it is also just the consideration that researchers need to be aware that certain kinds of obligations may arise and that they may, or certain kinds of issues may arise, and that they need to at least be prepared to address them from the outset. I'm not sure if researchers have experienced strong and stringent obligations to provide ancillary care imposed on them from IRBs, and I suspect that they might have some ground to say that in certain cases those types of obligations are not legitimate. But in other cases, I think there may be a strong ethical claim that researchers do have to address particular issues. Christine, did you want to talk about that?
I don't remember the words, but there is a statement in the ICH GCP that is similar in spirit to the SEAMS one, that in other words, that you don't have an obligation to provide ancillary care, but it would be a good thing to do. At the same time, ICH GCP very clearly says they rest on the principles enunciated in the Declaration of Helsinki. So to the extent that Helsinki addresses this, there's a little bit of a uncertainty, I guess is the right way to say it, about what ICHGCP requires with respect to ancillary care. I think it's also interesting your question about what recourse does an investigator have if the IRB says or the REC says, we're not going to approve this study because the ancillary care is inadequate or something like that. There was a conference that Henry Richardson organized a couple of years ago to try to sort of move forward this issue of ancillary care and how we might think about it. And one of the things that came out of that conference was a recommendation that at least review committees ask the question, you know, are there any plans for predictable needs of the population that you're going to encounter in this particular study? Are there plans for what you would do if you encounter, you know, a whole cohort of people who need treatment for malaria, let's say, and the study's not about malaria? How are you going to deal with that? And so those are not regulations or official guidelines, but there's a recommendation in the literature anyway that at least IRB should start to sort of approach the question of ancillary care from that perspective. Have you thought about it? Have you made some plans for what to do? Okay.
Okay, great. So,
thank you very much for introducing us to lots of the interesting questions that arise in international research. And I think our next speaker, who you do remember from a previous session, is Alan Wertheimer. He's a political scientist who has taught at the University of Vermont for many years and is now here with us in the Department of Bioethics. And I think he's going to help us explore something very central to all of these requirements. And it gets to your question, too, Ron. I mean, it's this question of what are we trying to protect people from or communities from? Most of the literature and most of the discussion is based on this notion that we don't want to exploit people. So Alan is going to help us think through what does that actually mean? What does exploitation really mean? Thank you, Alan.
Yeah, if I can. Okay. Yep. Okay. Oh, I thought I had colors here. So I hope, given that I did teach political science for many years, I can be forgiven for the fact that I'm running on empty this morning, like probably many of you are. But I'm still a bit of a political junkie. And you heard the usual disclaimer, but I want to add to that that some of the views that you're going to hear today are probably in disagreement with my colleagues in the Department of Bioethics. Our chair, Zeke Emanuel, from whom you have heard, I think, says that the ethos of the department is combative collegiality, okay? And we take the combative part pretty seriously. So my own views about exploitation not only don't represent an official view, I'm not sure that they represent my colleagues' views, okay? I want you to know that. Now, you've gotten, I think there are actually seven or eight principles, but you've heard the department's canon of the principles of research ethics. And I just wanted to note that some argue that many of these principles can, as a group, be understood under a kind of core concept of avoiding exploitation. So it might be thought, for example, that if research doesn't have social value, then we're exploiting subjects for no good purpose. If research isn't scientifically valid, if the methods aren't adequate, again, we would be exploiting people because we would be using them and not generating reliable knowledge. If we're not selecting subjects in a fair way, again, a kind of exploitation. If research isn't appropriately beneficial, again, we'd be using people in an exploitive way, and in the same for with respect to the idea of respect for human subjects. But the notion of exploitation, while it does have this kind of general appeal, I think has clearly come to the fore with respect to research with vulnerable populations, and in particular, with research in less developed countries. And your reading that accompanies this, I mean, has some of these examples in it. So, for example, research in placebo-controlled trials when proven effective treatment is available is said to be exploiting subjects. Research is said to be exploiting subjects when the intervention that's being studied is likely to be used for the benefit of developed countries, but not necessarily for the benefit of the countries in which the research takes place. And then the kind of research which Seema so helpfully described, cases of offshoring of clinical research, again, is often thought to be exploited. Here are three examples. Actually, one of them I'm just going to cut short because it was nicely anticipated by what Seema said. But we have the examples of the maternal-fetal transmission of HIV trials, again, which were discussed in your reading. Another example is, which I'll mention briefly, is the surfaxin trial, and then a kind of hypothetical example involving a diabetes drug. Now, I mean, as you're aware, in these trials, which were designed to test the efficacy of treatment for reducing maternal-fetal transmission of HIV, the efficacy of a long course treatment had been established. We knew that worked, you know, with reasonable degree of efficacy. The problem was that it was thought that this long course treatment was just not feasible and too expensive to be used in resource poor countries, less developed countries. And so researchers wanted to investigate the efficacy of a short course treatment. Would that help? They had every reason to think it would not be as efficacious as the long course treatment, but one thought, this might be economically feasible, administratively feasible. Would it be of any use at all? And what they wanted to do was to compare the efficacy of the short course treatment with no treatment or a placebo. Note that in this case, the intervention, if it proved efficacious, was actually not likely to be shipped back to the developed countries, but was likely to be of use in the less developed countries themselves. But the studies did involve intentionally withholding an established treatment from many of the subjects. Okay. And it was that fact, and again, you've seen it in your reading, which sent some people in the research ethics community up the wall. Okay, they thought that was outrageous to conduct a study where we intentionally withheld proven effective therapy. Note that in many of these countries, the local standard of care was nothing. There was nothing available. So while the researchers would be withholding established therapy from some of the subjects, they would not be withholding a treatment that would otherwise be available to those subjects. And that was the counter argument that some made with respect to those criticisms. A similar kind of trial, although it differs in one, I think, important respect, was the surfaxin trial. This was a proposal. This is not actually what happened. Discovery Labs, this is the name of the company, wanted to study a new sort of me-too synthetic surfactant treatment for respiratory distress syndrome. There were other established surfactant treatments available. Most of them were developed from animal tissue. They wanted to, they had in mind a surfactant therapy that was synthetically developed. It was very expensive. The target market for surfaxin was the United States and other developed countries. But what they wanted to do, what they originally proposed doing, they didn't actually end up doing this, was to conduct the trial in several sites, most of them in South America, where what they wanted to do was to run a placebo-controlled trial where surfaxin would be given to half of the infants and sham air, other half of the infants would receive ventilation therapy, but the ventilation would be infused with sham air, not surfactant-treated air. And again, it involved the intentional withholding of established surfactant therapy, as the comparison group. Again, note in this case that the local standard of care in many of the places that they wanted to do the study was nothing. They wouldn't have been depriving any infants of therapy that was otherwise available to them, but they would be intentionally withholding established therapy from those infants. And again, many people in the research ethics community were outraged by their proposal. Now, both of those studies involved denying some participants the established standard of care. There was, I think, a plausible scientific rationale for the placebo-controlled trial in the short course trial, in the HIV trial, because it wasn't a matter of comparative efficacy. It was a matter of knowing whether this treatment was better than nothing. Okay? And they probably could not have found out what they needed to find out without running a placebo-controlled trial. There was probably no or much less scientific rationale. There was some scientific rationale for a placebo-controlled trial. They could have gotten the data faster. Data might have been clearer. But there was not any compelling rationale for running a placebo-controlled trial in the surfactant trial. But again, neither trial, this is, I think, important. This was the kind of comeback that was made. And you can think about whether it's an adequate comeback. Neither trial would have withheld any therapy that would otherwise have been available to these participants. And then we can imagine another kind of claim about exploitation involving something like a trial that Seema mentioned, and I won't spend any more time on it here. Now, these are the kinds of things that are said. Note that Siam says this, that if the knowledge gained from the research in such a country is used primarily for the benefit of populations that can afford the tested products, the research may rightly be characterized as exploitative and therefore unethical. So if it's used for the benefit of rich countries, if people in less developed countries are being used for the benefit of people in rich countries, the claim is that it's exploitative and unethical. Peter Lurie and Sidney Wolfe say, this quote is from something that's in your reading, residents of impoverished post-colonial countries, the majority of whom are people of color, must be protected against from potential exploitation in research. Otherwise, the abominable state of health care in these countries can be used to justify studies that could never pass ethical muster in the sponsoring country. Now, behind these kinds of arguments, which use the language of exploitation, I mean, who could be in favor of something called exploitation? I mean, if it's exploitative, it's unethical, right? Can't be done, right? That's the question. We want to find out, well, what does it mean to talk about exploitation, and what is its moral force? And I think what you find, ignore the 2A and 3A, because I cut out a slide. I was going to actually do a little more elaborate. I decided to simplify things. So, 1, 2, and 3. What you see... and here I'm sorry, this is bringing out the philosopher in me, but that's what I'm hired to do. The argument is a kind of very simple syllogism. It's claimed, proposition one, that if a practice is exploitative, it shouldn't be permitted. And then the second claim is that a placebo-controlled trial, such as the short course trial or the surfactant trial, are exploitative, and therefore, well, if it's exploitative, it shouldn't be permitted. If these are exploitative, then you get the obvious conclusion. That they shouldn't be permitted. Question is, should we accept that argument? That's the question that I want to ask. Well, first we have to ask, when is too true? When is a trial exploitative? We need to say more about that. I mean, you can call something exploitative, but you need an account of when something's exploitative. You can't just say, well, it's exploitative. Well, you think it is, I think it isn't. We need to say something about that. But I actually think there's an interesting question as to whether we should accept the first premise. Remember, the first premise says that if a practice is exploitative, it should not be permitted. Should we prohibit a trial solely on the grounds that it's exploitative? That, I think, is a very real question, and I'm going to spend some time on. There's actually a third question that I would want to note. Who is exploited? It's interesting that if you read Lurie and Wolfe, and see, it's not clear whether they actually have, is it the community that's being exploited? Is it the particular subjects in the trial that's being exploited? Is it both? Okay. There's actually a remarkable lack of clarity among the people who claim that it's exploited as, well, who's being exploited? Okay. Who are you really worried about? Are you worried about the research participants, or are you worried about the communities from which these participants are drawn? Well, what does it mean to exploit? Here is a true but vacuous statement, okay? A exploits B when A takes unfair advantage of B. Well, the problem with that, I think that's actually a pretty decent definition of exploitation. The problem doesn't tell us anything. When are we taking unfair advantage of people? Well, I like to work with examples. So here are some examples of exploitation. Many of them have nothing to do with research. I like to work with lots of sort of ordinary kinds of examples in which people talk about it. I mean, so famous, awful case in history of exploitation when, Nazi medical scientists used people in death camps to develop knowledge about which they thought would be useful. Many people think that kidney sales are a case of exploitation. A, who is affluent, offers to pay B $25,000 for one of his kidneys for purpose of transplantation. B, who is poor, agrees in order to provide better for his family. Many people think that's exploitation. You're exploiting the poverty of this person to get an organ, right? I mean, it's the kind of thing that many people say. Here's a case, again, I come from Vermont, I still live up there, I commute down here, kind of thing that occurs, not in Washington or Maryland, but occurs, you know, we have big snowstorms, actually snowed a couple weeks ago. B's car's in a snowbank on a rural road late at night, and A stops and ascertains that it'll take him 2 minutes to pull it out. And he offers to pull it out for $100 or $200. Maybe say, that's exploitation, right? You're taking unfair advantage of this guy in that case, right? I mean, the rescuer is ripping the guy off, right? I mean, it's sort of classic, mundane, ordinary, day-by-day case of exploitation. Probably things like that have no doubt happened to many people here, or they thought they've been exploited. Psychotherapy. We talk about this in the language that we use. Sexual exploitation and psychotherapy is what we worry about there. A psychotherapist proposes to B, his patient, that they have sexual relations. And B happens to be, this happens in psychotherapy, becomes infatuated with her therapist and agrees. B might even propose it. But we think that's exploitation. Therapist has to say no, right? I mean, otherwise it'd be exploiting the patient. Or slavery, a kind of obvious case of exploitation, or a case which I'll call sweatshops, where Nike hires unemployed people in let's say Thailand, and the employees work long hours for $1 an hour, which, by the way, is, let's suppose, is considerably above the average wage in Thailand, but much obviously lower than anything that would be acceptable in the United States. And many people, look, that you're exploiting these people. Nike's engaged in exploitation, many people would think. And, you know, therefore we shouldn't buy his products. We should boycott the stores that sell products made in sweatshops and so forth and so on, right? It's all based on the notion of exploitation. Well, I think it's very important. This is, you know, maybe the single idea of most importance in this talk today. That we distinguish between two kinds of exploitation. What I'm going to call harmful and non-consensual exploitation and mutually advantageous and consensual exploitation. I think there's an important difference here. In harmful and non-consensual exploitation, the exploiter benefits, but the exploitee is harmed. And the exploitee does not give valid consent. That's harmful and I think Nazi psychotherapy and slavery are examples of harmful and non-consensual exploitation. In psychotherapy, note, there might be consent, but we would say it's not valid consent because perhaps the patient is in the grips of transference and isn't really giving competent consent under the circumstances. By contrast, let's talk about mutually advantageous and consensual exploitation. The exploiter benefits, but I think there are cases in which the exploitee benefits as well. The transaction also is better for him or her. And where the exploitee gives valid consent. I think this might be true in kidneys. I think it's probably true in the rescue case and might be true in the sweatshop case as well. If somebody wants to pull me out for $100 or $200 and I'm stuck in a snowbank, I think they may be exploiting me, but I'm benefiting from it. Might be worth more than $200 to get pulled out under the circumstances, and I'm consenting to it. Nobody's holding a gun to my head. I know what I'm doing. There's no fraud. There's no deception. There's no coercion. It's a case, in my view, of what we call, of what I call, mutually advantageous and consensual exploitation. Well, a couple of quick thoughts, or maybe more than two. First of all, harmful and non-consensual exploitation is a no-brainer. I mean, it's wrong, it should be prohibited, end of story. Mutually advantageous and consensual exploitation is not as bad as harmful and non-consensual, but it's more interesting and more complicated. Because then we have to ask, well, what is it about it that makes it exploited? Why is rescue a case of exploitation? Why is kidney a case of exploitation? Why is the sweatshop case a case of exploitation? And then we have to ask a second question. Should we prohibit it? After all, if it's better for both parties and they consent to it, why not just let it go? We could ask. Okay? Why should we get involved in prohibiting that kind of exploitation? Well, let's suppose we have a transaction that is mutually advantageous and consensual. Let's suppose we stipulate that. When is such a transaction exploited? What makes something unfair? Well, some people might appeal to, this is what Justice Potter Stewart, it's a very famous case from the United States Supreme Court many years ago, it was a pornography or obscenity case. He said, I shall not today attempt further to define the kinds of material I understand to be embraced by the concept of pornography or exploitation, but I know it when I see it. Stewart says, look, I can't define pornography for you or obscenity for you, but I know it when I see it. Okay? Well, some people might say that about exploitation. I can't define what makes it unfair, but I know it when I see it. I know that rescue is unfair. Okay? Well, I actually think appearances can be deceiving here. I don't think that's an adequate approach. Okay? For example, I mean, let's suppose that the rescuer charges $200. But suppose that what this guy does is he on snowy nights, he goes out and travels all around. You think this is a way to learn, you know, to earn a little extra money, waiting to see somebody who's stuck on the side of the road and offering to pull them out. But he actually has to spend a lot of time driving around and often has no customers. So, you know, if you average out his income, it turns out to be $20 an hour. I mean, it may be $200 for 2 minutes of his time with me, but if you take all the time, well, if that's what he's actually earning, I'm not sure he's exploiting anybody. Okay? True, I mean, I may feel it's a lot of money, but I'm not, you know, I mean, he's out there trying to make a decent buck. $20 an hour isn't a tremendous amount of money. So I'm not sure that's a case of exploitation. We need to know more, I think, before we say that something is unfair. Well, here's another definition. Some people say it's exploitative when you take advantage of somebody's vulnerability. When we take advantage of somebody's vulnerability, we're exploiting them. I don't think that view can be correct. Because all kinds of people make their living taking advantage of other people's vulnerability. And it can be a perfectly respectable, I know, look, my daughter's a lawyer, it can be a perfectly respectable occupation. Doctors earn their living taking advantage of people's vulnerability. Lawyers do. Plumbers do. Directors of homeless shelters do. Okay? You know, consider a case. I call it surgery. A proposes to amputate B's leg for a fair fee because B will die unless she agrees to the amputation. Now, the surgeon's taking advantage of this person's vulnerability. But there's nothing unfair in the transaction. And what that suggests to me is that the notion of it can't be exploited merely because you're taking advantage of somebody's vulnerability. There has to be something unfair about the terms of the transaction. Well, what could that be? It's important, I think, to distinguish between the claim that A is taking unfair advantage of someone, that's exploitation, and that A is taking advantage of an unfairness to somebody, or perhaps their unfortunate circumstances. Consider a case, I call it the unemployed lawyer. I hope my daughter doesn't fall into that category. That B has been unjustly fired. He was making $150,000 a year. And now A offers B a job teaching at a community college for $30,000. Note that A in this case is taking advantage of an unfairness to B. Right? Assuming that B has been unjustly fired. B has been treated unfairly. A is taking advantage of that fact to get itself a teacher. But there's no exploitation going on there, in my view. I mean, it might be that 30,000, make it 40,000, doesn't matter. A is taking advantage of an unfairness, but A isn't taking unfair advantage. Okay, under those conditions. So it's important, I think, to keep those concepts distinct. Well, when are transactions unfair? Some people think the transactions are fair when there's a kind of disproportionate benefit. Many people think it's unfair. Well, when A gains more than B from the transaction, that's what makes the transaction unfair. That's the most popular view of exploitation. Somebody's gaining more than someone else. It seems plausible, and yet I think it's clearly wrong. Consider a case, unfair surgery. Just like the previous case, except this time A charges three times his normal fee. But who's gaining more? B's getting more, A's getting more money than A should, but B's getting life. It's a counterintuitive It's a counterintuitive notion, but I think that it is true nonetheless that in most unfair exploitative transactions, the weaker party actually gains more than the stronger party. If you measure it in terms of relative utility from the transaction. It's precisely, you know, if you think about a bargaining situation, you're in the stronger situation when you can walk away from the deal. I'm not getting that much. I'm out of here. That's what puts somebody in a strong position. It's not that they're gaining a lot. It's that they're not gaining that much. That's why they have so much bargaining leverage. It's the person who's going to be gaining a lot that's in a very weak position. So somewhat counterintuitively, I think you can't measure exploitation by sort of comparing the relative benefits. You need some kind of account of fairness. Here's, again, a completely vacuous statement. So when are transactions unfair? Transactions are unfair when A gains more than A should gain or when B gains less than B should gain. We need a theory of fair transactions. I actually have one, but I'm going to spare it. Okay, today. Okay. And believe me, you should be glad that I'm not going to inflict it on you. Okay? I'm just going to assume that transactions can be exploited, even if they're mutually advantageous and consensual, so that we can examine the major premise in the argument that I advanced before. If you want more on that, you can take a look at the book where I try to explain why I think transactions are unfair. So should we prohibit mutually advantageous and consensual exploitation? One is that major premise. If a practice is exploitative, it shouldn't be permitted. That's the premise that we're considering now. So let's assume that A is under no obligation to transact with B. If A were to stay away, and this could be researchers now. We might think, researchers don't have to go there. They're not under an obligation to go there. Okay. So let's suppose that A is under no, the rescuer doesn't have to stop to pull me out. Let's assume that B gains from the transaction with A, that B consents to the transaction with A, but let's assume that the transaction is nonetheless unfair. Should we interfere? Should we try to say, no, you can't do that? That's the question. In thinking about the wrongness of exploitation, I mean, it's actually interesting to compare the notion of exploitation with what I call neglect. Okay? Consider what I call Nike and Hike. Okay? So Nike is like the case that I described before. It employs people in sweatshops. Now imagine another firm. We'll just call it Hike, but for comparison, it takes a hike. Okay? It doesn't go there. It's another manufacturer of athletic shoes, and it doesn't want to. It's seen what's happened to Nike. Nike gets all kinds of crap about exploiting people and says, no, look, we can't compete with Nike over there. We can't actually afford to pay more than they do, so we're going to open up a factory in the United States. Highly automated. Who's acting unethically? Nike or Hike or both? Note what's interesting to me, and it is that it's at least arguable. We might think that Nike's exploiting people, but note that it's at least arguable that Nike's actually doing more for these people than Hike. Assuming that the people actually benefit from being employed in the Nike factory. So we might actually think, it's not clear what we should think about the case. We might think, well, you know, maybe Nike isn't as bad as we thought it was. Of course, we could have the opposite view. Maybe Hike's worse than we thought it was because it's not doing as much as Nike. But in any case, should we prohibit mutually advantageous and consensual exploitation? I think that if interference is worse for the exploitees, then probably not. We wouldn't be engaged in protecting people. There was the question after Seema's talk about paternalism. Should we protect, you know, would it be right to protect people from something that benefits them? Okay. But interference in an interesting way, preventing people from exploiting others, could actually work to people's benefit if it prevents what I've called a race to the bottom. I mean, consider minimum wage laws. It could be that if employers in the United States were not subject, some employers, subject to minimum wage laws, they would drive down the wages and pay people very low amounts. If there's high unemployment rate, people are going to be competing for jobs. So it could be that what the laws do by saying, you can't hire somebody for $4 an hour. I know that they might agree to it, and I know that you might be willing to pay it, but we're not going to let you do that. But what we hope in some such cases is that by not permitting the transaction, we don't drive the transaction away. We hope that the same transaction will occur, but on better terms. So if they can't employ you for $4 an hour, maybe they go ahead and do it for $7. I mean, that's the way we hope minimum wage laws work. And if it works that way, I think interference with mutually advantageous and consensual exploitation may be justified. But it's an empirical question as to actually what will happen if we prohibit what we regard as exploitative. It might work out in the first case, it might work out as an example of the second. So let's talk about exploitation in clinical research. Is the surfaxin trial exploited? That's one question. And if so, should regulators have refused to allow Discovery Labs to do this trial in Latin America and withhold the standard of care from half of the infants? I think it's, by the way, very important in thinking about this question to think about what I'm calling a division of moral labor. I think investigators have to worry about the ethics of their activities. They shouldn't exploit. I think that's true. Now, we can argue about what counts as exploitation, but I think, in general, you shouldn't exploit. But the question facing regulators is actually different. They have to worry about the ethics of interfering with research. Should they stop investigators from exploiting? That's actually a different question. It's important to recognize that it is sometimes the case that we should allow people to do something that's wrong. Perfect example. Free speech. Somebody wants to give a hate speech. Somebody wants, maybe he's a Holocaust denier, and give a talk denying that the Holocaust ever happened. It's wrong to do that. But it might also be wrong to interfere with it. Right? I mean, I think that's a standard view about free speech. By the way, I mean, we can disagree about whether we should interfere, but many people think, no, the fact that somebody shouldn't be saying what they're saying is not a reason to interfere with what they're saying. And I think the same could be true about exploitation in clinical research. It could be that investigators shouldn't be doing what they're doing. But it might also be the case some of the time that we shouldn't prevent them from doing it. It doesn't just follow as automatically as some people think that, well, if it's wrong for somebody to do it, then we ought to prevent them from doing it. That's a different question. Well, note the standard care principle, which I think Seema talked about, from the Declaration of Helsinki. This may not be actually, it was just revised. This is close enough, but the 2008 version language might be slightly different. In any medical study, every patient, including those of a control group, if any, should be assured of the best proven diagnostic and therapeutic method. Note that if that principle were followed, the surfaxin trial should not happen. Okay? And in fact, if that principle were followed, the short course treatment trial should not have occurred either. Does the standard care principle actually help subjects? Well, maybe. Such regulations may prevent a kind of race to the bottom, which is sort of similar to minimum wage law. It could be that if we insist on standard care, subjects will be better off. Possible. But it's also possible that researchers may go elsewhere if placebo-controlled trials, such as the surfaxin trial, are disallowed. That's actually what happened. It's not that regulators actually said the Discovery Labs couldn't do it, but they were subjected to so much criticism that they pulled their proposal and they conducted the research in developed countries where surfactant therapy was available. Okay? They did it as an active control trial, a superiority study, and not as a placebo-controlled trial. That's what actually happened in the case. But note, having done that, it's not as if the infants in Bolivia were better off. Now they got nothing, as far as the surfactant trial was concerned. So it's an empirical question as to whether disallowing placebo-controlled trials actually helps potential subjects. Facts matter. We need to find out what would actually happen. Again, I think we have to ask that this is a statement from David Rothman. Abject poverty is harsh enough without people having to bear the additional burdens of serving a research subject. Note the term burden in this kind of statement. It's a bit, it sort of begs the question as to whether being a research participant is actually a burden. If people, it may be a burden in a kind of general way, but if people actually benefit from participating in research, if they benefit, I'm not saying that they always do. We all know otherwise. There are lots of cases of research where people are harmed, where they haven't given adequate consent, where they actually are burdened, sometimes not voluntarily, by participating in research. But what if they do benefit? Then it's not clear that it's actually right to talk about them having the burden of research. Now let me talk for a minute about the fair benefits principle, which Seema talked about. This is a kind of standard statement. Now, I mean, I actually have some questions about the fair benefits principle. Note the fair benefits principle is designed to counteract exploitation by providing benefits to the community and said, well, maybe then we won't be exploiting them so much. Well, I just want to ask a couple of questions. I mean, if it is wrong to ask subjects to participate in research because it's exploiting the individual subject or harming the individual subject, how does it become permissible just because they're fellow citizens or the community's benefit? I mean, suppose you do provide benefits to the community. That doesn't seem to me to make it okay to actually exploit the subjects themselves. So I wonder why fair benefits is important in that case. Well, suppose that the subjects do benefit. If it's not wrong to ask these subjects to participate because they benefit and consent, why is it necessary that their fellow citizens benefit? I think that question has to be asked. I'm not suggesting that there isn't good reason for their fellow citizens to benefit. But it's not obvious why that's so. I mean, you know, I'm the one who's participated in research. Where are my fellow citizens? Why should they be getting a benefit just because I've participated in research? I think that's a question that isn't asked often enough. But my general point here that I want to make about worries about exploitation in research is that before we adopt principles for the regulation of research, we need to know how they actually affect behavior. We can't assume that good intentions, and I have no doubt that most of the principles, like the standard of care principle, fair benefits principle, and so were well intended, but we can't assume that good intentions and high-minded principles actually achieve their goals. Here's my favorite example of this phenomenon. It's what I call the FAA example. True case, okay? The FAA once proposed requiring that every infant be placed in a child restraint in its own seat rather than being held by an adult in airplane, okay? Because they thought it's not safe for infants to be held by their parents on a plane. It's much safer for the child in case of turbulence, or heaven forbid a crash, that the child actually be in its own seat, in a car seat, in a restraint, held by the seatbelt. Okay? So the evidence suggested this was safer. But interestingly, the evidence also suggested that the requirement would lead to more infant death because some parents say, you require me to buy a ticket for my kid? I'm not taking a plane. I'll drive. Too expensive. And the evidence suggested that it's safer being held by an infant, it's safer being held by an adult in a plane than being put in a child seat in a car. Cars are just that much more dangerous. So when the evidence suggested, quite clearly that the FAA rule was actually going to lead to more infant deaths or injuries, not fewer, in this circuitous way, they pulled the regulation. Because as well-intentioned as the principle was, it wasn't going to achieve its goal when you look at the world. It wasn't going to achieve its goal of actually helping infants. It was going to hurt them, not help them. I think there's an important lesson in that kind of regulation. We need to find out what the actual effects of imposing a certain kind of regulation are. And so my conclusion is that we won't resolve questions about the justifiability of studies such as the short course trial or the diabetes trial or the surfactant trial by appeal to the derisive language of exploitation. I just don't think saying that's exploitative is all that helpful. So while I've spent too many years worrying about the concept of exploitation, one of my views is that we should probably not worry about that language as much as we do. We need to, the questions that we're interested in, should we allow this study, aren't going to be resolved by talking about exploitation. They're going to be resolved by talking about ethical arguments and by the study of the effects of various policies on people's lives. What actually happens to people? Are they better off or worse off because of the kinds of regulations and ethical principles that we advance? If they're better off, go for it. But if they're not better off, I think we should be cautious.
Alan, you, in discussing the exploitation which is mutually beneficial and consensual, you discuss it in the paradigm of either to permit it or not to permit it. You discuss it from the paradigm of either saying, should this be permitted or not permitted? My question is that if it is permissible, but nonetheless it is somewhat noxious, should it be regulated? To say that, you know, the surgeon can't charge three times the usual fare, but he can charge 1.5 times, thus enabling the mutually beneficial exploitation,
right,
but nonetheless at least making it somewhat less toxic than it would otherwise be.
Right. Should we regulate it? I think what I would, first of all, if it's exploitative, I think we want to encourage people to do the right thing, okay? And by the way, in Vermont, people are nice in Vermont. They wouldn't rip me off like that in Vermont, okay? Okay. Maybe down here, but not up there, okay? Should we regulate it? Well, actually, I think that's an interesting question. We'd want to know what would happen if we do. Now, actually, in that kind of case, the law actually has a notion of unconscionable contracts. There are certain kinds of deals which the law does not allow because it says the terms are so exploitative that we're not going to allow it. But I think the point there that the law is hoping that, if we say to this guy, you can't charge him $200, well, then maybe he'll do it for a fair fee. It's not that he'll walk away. It's that we hope that what it will do is to get the person to do better. And if that's what happens, I think then regulation might make a lot of sense. But I think that's what we need to know. I don't think these kinds of issues can be sort of settled by us sitting around a table. You know, we actually need to study, like in the case of that FAA regulation, what will actually happen if we restrict people in these ways? Will it help people or not?
That was a very interesting lecture, so thank you for that. I'm going to ask a somewhat technical question, so I do apologize to the audience. So I haven't read your account of exploitation yet, but it seems that in the differences you discuss between the kinds of exploitations that are okay and the kind of exploitations that we should worry about, I was wondering if there was any room for a Kantian approach to this. So Kantian approach says something like, something is good is if we adopted it as a general policy, it would be a good thing. And something is bad that it, in case if we adopted it as a general policy, it would be a bad thing. So if you look at the guy who's driving around Vermont in his truck, now, if he is someone who really drives around and makes $20 an hour, you know, which means that I have to pay him $200 to be pulled out of the snow. Now, as a general policy, that would be a good thing, because
that's
right. If we had a couple of people driving around like that, we would all benefit. Whereas if he was a guy who just happened to pass and just happened to see an opportunity, you know, to make a lot of benefit out of my situation. Now, if everyone went around doing that, that would be a really bad general
That's right.
policy.
Yep.
So I wonder if there's any room here for using some kind of Kantian stuff.
Well, I think that's exactly right. And so our ability to distinguish whether what's happened there is an okay thing or a not okay thing. I mean, one way, I don't want to get into a discussion of Kant, but let me just put it this way. What your point suggests is that we can't just look at the case itself to figure out the ethics of what's going on. We need to situate it in a broader context. You know, I might feel ripped off if he charges me $200, but I think that feeling should go away if I know that he's actually, you know, spent 10 hours driving around waiting for somebody like me to run off. And so the principle that says it's okay in the one context and not okay in the other, I think, is precisely, well, would we want this to be adopted as a kind of universal principle? And no, I think that's right. I think the question was, what was the problem in the case that I called psychotherapy? I think the general view in the United States, at least, is that psychotherapists and patients are often not in a good position to determine whether the consent that's on offer in these cases is really genuine consent, whether the B person in this case is subject to sort of distortions of thinking. We talk about transference as a phenomenon in psychotherapy, and that we have good reason to think that even when the parties think it's consensual and think that they're going to be better off, that it's generally harmful. It destroys the psychotherapy relationship. People end up being harmed when those sorts of things occur. Not necessarily always. I mean, is it possible that some such cases might actually work out fine for absolutely. But given that the parties involved are probably not in a good position to determine whether they're the exception to the rule, the principle that we adopt is no. It shouldn't happen, period. And that's a case of paternalism, it could be said, but I think of justifiable paternalism, because I think we are justified in being paternalistic when we have good reason to think that people don't know what they're doing under those circumstances. That's... For more, I don't remember which chapter, but in my book on exploitation, there is a excessively long chapter on sexual exploitation and psychotherapy.
Can you use the mic?
In your framework,
while
she's going to the microphone, in your framework, how do you account for, if we take the example from the earlier lecture, Burkitt's kills virtually all the children that develop Burkitt's. Tuberculosis, you know, creates an ill life but doesn't kill 100% necessarily in a short-term period. So is your structure then giving extra benefit, so to speak, for something that helps the individual a great deal, i.e. saves their life, as in the amputation, versus gives a little bit of benefit to a great many people? but not the equivalent of saving life, for example.
And so I'm not sure I've got the question.
Well, how does one account for something that benefits the individual greatly, i.e. saves the life, but of a smaller number of people than a study with an intervention that makes life better for a larger number of people?
Okay. I mean, that's, well, there, I mean, that might be recast as a question about how to allocate research resources, and should we, you know, use resources to help a smaller number of people, to a greater degree of magnitude, or a larger number of people to, suppose we could, save one life or cure 1,000 headaches, or 1,000,000 headaches or 10,000,000 headaches, actually philosophical articles written on exactly that question. But I don't know that that's really a question about the exploitation of research subjects. I mean, I think it's a very important question.
For the one who dies, it's clearly.
I'm sorry?
For the single individual who dies, that's the ultimate exploitation because of neglect, right?
Well, I would distinguish between exploitation and neglect. We might think that it's very bad to neglect, but we're not exploiting somebody if we don't use them. If we ignore them, it may be wrong. I mean, if the fellow drives by me on the road, leaving me in the ditch, he may be neglecting me, he may be acting wrongly, but he's not exploiting me. Not an issue about exploitation. And so I think what we need to bear in mind, and that was what I had in mind by the comparison of exploitation and neglect, is that exploitation is a very special kind of wrong, and there are other wrongs out there that may be just as wrong, if not worse, than exploitation. There's an economist who once said that the misery of being exploited is, awful, but it doesn't compare to the misery of not being exploited at all. Okay? And I think that is sometimes the case.
I was just going to ask, but I'm probably just tired because I stayed up till 1 watching the elections.
I'm sorry.
I said I'm going to apologize if this doesn't make sense because I was up watching.
No, it's just that I don't hear
Obama and everybody until 1 in the morning. But so you're talking about like Nike and Hike.
Right.
And you're talking about the car and the snow.
Right.
But I didn't really see the patient side of it, that you were talking about exploitation and clinical research. And I mean, that happens every day. You know, an investigator wants to push someone into a study to have the data to analyze it. I mean, so I just see this seems more like everyday life than the clinical research world.
Well, you're absolutely right. I mean, my task was to try to shed some light on the concept of exploitation. People use it in the context of clinical research, and my approach is to try to open up the concept and appeal to everyday life, because the point is that exploitation we use in a variety of contexts. So I want to get clear on what it means. Now, once we've done that, I think then we can try to apply the distinctions which I have advanced. We can ask about a case of alleged exploitation in clinical research. Look, what do we mean? Do we think the subject's being harmed? Do we think that the subject has not given valid consent? Or do we think that this is a case where the subject actually does benefit and does give valid consent? Which kind of exploitation is it? Okay. And once we have that kind of conceptual framework, I think, in front of us, I would like to think that we can make more progress in the way we analyze cases in clinical research. So I think we need to step back or out before we go back in, okay? You can go back in. Okay, you don't need me. I mean, you know more about clinical research, no doubt, than I do. Okay, and so I'd like to think that with some of these conceptual frameworks advanced, that you'll be able to think about the cases of alleged exploitation in clinical research in a clearer way.
Okay, 15-minute break. Okay. So our third session today will be continuing on the discussion of interesting and controversial issues in the conduct of international research. And specifically, we have Ridar Lee with us, who is an MD, PhD, who works with us in the Clinical Center Department of Bioethics. And he's going to address standard of care and outsourcing of clinical trials and pick up on some of the themes that have been already introduced.
Christine, what I will do, the two previous speakers have talked about, have given a general overview of the issues of international research ethics. And then we have heard an analysis of the concept of exploitation that is central when we discuss international research ethics. What I want to do is to concentrate on two specific areas of international research ethics. The issue that Seema mentioned, what standards, what treatments, what interventions should be provided to participants in a trial, and then do we have any obligations to do research that is responsive to the health needs of the community in which we do research. What I will do is not give you a sophisticated theoretical analysis. What I will do is to give you a number of cases during my presentation, and I will give you my analysis of those cases to sort of give an illustration of how I think we should think about them. So some of the things I say, as Alan mentioned, we don't always disagree, may actually disagree with the previous speakers, but that is the way this is, and I think that's a fruitful approach to have. So let's now look at, again, what you have seen earlier in terms of the Declaration of Helsinki, the current version that was just adopted in Seoul a couple of weeks ago, because that is what addresses the standard of care, the interventions to be provided to the participants in the trial. It says the benefits, risks, burdens, and effectiveness of a new intervention must be tested against those of the best current proven intervention, except in the following circumstances. And the first circumstance is the use of placebo or no treatment. Notice that it says only here treatment, no treatment or placebo. It doesn't really address the general questions, what kind of interventions you should provide to participants in the trial. It exclusively focuses on placebos in the control arm, which I think is a deficiency in the formulation of the Declaration of Helsinki. So the first condition is when there is no acceptable treatment, and that's an obvious case. If you don't have a treatment, of course, you can you don't have to provide any treatment in the control arm, or you can provide placebo. Then there's an or, and the next condition is where for compelling and scientifically sound methodological reasons, the use of placebo is necessary to determine the efficacy or safety of an intervention and an intervention. So that's the first condition. It is scientifically necessary. And then there comes an and. The patients who receive placebo or no treatment will not be subject to any risk of serious or irreversible harm. So these are the two conditions with an and between them. There has to be a scientific need to do the study with a placebo, even if there is an effective intervention available, and you don't cause serious or irreversible harm to your study participants. Now, that is also controversial, but it is relatively uncontroversial. And Frank Miller discussed that earlier, so I won't go over the details of that, the justification for that. There are scientific reasons for why you sometimes want to do it when there is variability in the placebo response and you can't get valid results otherwise. But the condition is important that if you do so, you don't cause any serious harm. So the kinds of conditions we are looking at is testing of a new antihistamine for a runny nose, minor elevations of blood pressure. These are the uncontroversial examples here. Here we don't think it is a major problem to withhold effective therapy. But the kinds of discussions, the kinds of cases we are discussing in the international settings do involve serious or irreversible harm when we withhold treatment, such as the perinatal HIV transmission trials that were discussed earlier, and I will come back to that, where you are denying treatment that would prevent HIV infection, and that is a serious harm. Of course, nobody disagrees with that. But when they only talk about placebos and no treatment. They don't really talk about whether you can provide inferior care in the control arm. It's either no treatment or placebo or the standard of care. But if you think of what they are trying to say, and I think what is generally behind the Declaration of Helsinki, it is a statement or it is a position that the control group should receive the state-of-the-art care and should not receive an inferior care. It's not really the issue of placebo or no treatment that is central in the intention behind the Declaration of Helsinki, although they don't formulate it in that particular way. So it is a prohibition against providing inferior care to your control arm than compared to the state-of-the-art care. So that is the position of the Declaration of Helsinki, and many people agree with that. I have argued it is problematic, and I will do so by giving you a couple of examples. So let's again look at the perinatal HIV transmission trial, which was the first case that received international attention and that raised this particular issue. Both Seema and Alan mentioned it, so we'll go through it quite quickly. A well-known trial had demonstrated that giving AZT 13 weeks during pregnancy, last weeks of pregnancy, intravenously during delivery and to the baby after birth, reduced transmission of HIV from mother to child dramatically from around 30% to less than 10%. So that's was a dramatic result, a fantastic result. You could now reduce transmission from an HIV-positive mother to the uninfected child, and it immediately became the standard of care that was adopted in resource-rich settings. Two problems with that. It was expensive regimen in terms of the drug cost, AZT for 13 weeks, but that could be dealt with. I mean, the drug costs have come down, but also logistically, difficult to implement in resource-poor settings, having the infrastructure available, intravenous delivery, etc. So everybody realized immediately that this is not applicable in resource-poor settings. The second issue was that it was known, the same problem that you heard about from Frank Miller, with regard to what the placebo transmission was, or transmission without any treatment. There was data from South Africa showing variability in the transmission from mother to child when you didn't provide any interventions. So that is the reason why people argued, one, we need to have a no-treatment group in the control because we don't know what the true no-treatment transmission is, and we need to find an intervention that is suitable for a resource-poor setting, a shorter one than this one. And that's why a number of agencies started trials with a shorter intervention in the intervention arm and no treatment or placebo in the control arm. And they argued this was scientifically necessary, and we are doing this to identify an intervention that is going to be useful in the country where we are doing the trial. That was a justification for the trial. Another international guideline, Council of International Organization of Medical Sciences, which is a WHO-associated organization that has developed guidelines, particularly of relevance for developing countries, they would permit this trial. The Declaration of Helsinki obviously wouldn't permit the trial because it is denying participants in a trial an effective intervention, and that intervention that you have is preventing serious harm. Nobody disagrees that HIV infection is a serious harm. But if we look at this particular guidelines, here you have a different position, actually allowing this particular trial, at least in principle. There is still a theoretical question whether it's scientifically necessary and whether this intervention actually is useful, but we'll leave that aside. But in principle, this guidance document would allow this particular trial. So placebos are permitted according to the CIOM's guidelines in these kind of relatively trivial cases, but also they allow for an exception, an additional exception that is not allowed by the Declaration of Helsinki. And it's a long sentence, and I'll read it very quickly. An exception to the general rule is applicable in some studies designed to develop a therapeutic preventive or diagnostic intervention for use in a country or community in which an established effective intervention is not available and unlikely in the foreseeable future to become available, usually for economic or logistic reasons. So this is the situation. You have an established effective intervention that's only really applicable in resource-rich settings, and that won't be available in a resource-poor poor setting. And in this kind of situation, you allow for an additional exception to the general rule. The purpose of this study is to make available to the population of the country or community an effective alternative to an established effective intervention that is locally unavailable. So this is precisely the purpose of the perinatal HIV transmission studies. The purpose is to make this short course available in the country. Whether it's actually a good one, we will leave that aside. That was some discussion about that. The Scientific and Ethical Review Committee must be satisfied, this is the second condition, that the established effective intervention cannot be used as a comparator because its use would yield scientifically reliable, would not yield scientifically reliable results that would be relevant to the health needs of the population. So the second condition is scientific need to do the trial in this particular way. And the argument here was that it was a variability in the no treatment arm data from South Africa showing that. So the second condition, too, is fulfilled in principle. In these circumstances, the Ethics Review Committee may approve such a trial. So there's a clear disagreement here between this Declaration of Helsinki on the one hand and the CIOMS guidelines on the other hand. Now I will just show you two more examples of the kind of studies that would be prohibited by the Declaration of Helsinki and would be allowed by the CIOMS guidelines, because this illustrates, I think, again, the need for some kind of exception, and we can discuss what the details of the conditions should be. First example is a development of a simplified test to monitor HIV infection. We have a treatment rollout program now. Great number of people in resource-poor settings are getting HIV treatment. It's necessary to monitor treatment while you do so. The gold standard is viral load measurements. That's expensive, complicated, needs infrastructure, and so on, and is not available in all settings. So it could be a limitation on the rollout of treatment. So one may then want to propose a simplified method of monitoring treatment success and when one should change treatment. So one may propose a trial where you compare the gold standard viral load measurements with a simplified diagnostic test such as total lymphocyte count, and you compare the two. To see if that is useful in this particular setting. Now, that would be prohibited according to the Declaration of Helsinki, because you knowingly provide an intervention in one arm that is known to be inferior to the gold standard, and that is what is prohibited according to the principle of Declaration of Helsinki. But it could be allowed according to the CIOMS guidelines, because the reason you do it is to provide an intervention that's going to be useful in that particular setting, and you need to compare these two in order to get the results that you want. And I think this then illustrates that one may want to have an exception to the rule by the that is advocated by the Declaration of Helsinki. The second one is a number of trials that are currently carried out, funded by a number of different agencies, to see if we can prevent transmission of breastfeeding transmission of HIV during the breastfeeding period. We now are able to prevent transmission of HIV from mother to child during pregnancy and delivery by a very simple intervention, nevirapine, but transmission still occurs during the breastfeeding period. In resource-rich setting, there is a very effective way of preventing transmission in that time period, and that is to require formula feeding, bottle feeding of the baby. That reduces transmission to almost zero during the time after the delivery. That is not possible to do, or is not recommended to do, in resource-poor setting where there is a very poor access to clean water. Because even if you have a risk of HIV transmission, you have a risk of diarrheal diseases because you don't have access to clean water. So the recommendation is that you should breastfeed the baby even though you have a risk of HIV infection. Overall, the baby is better off breastfeeding and will survive, have a higher likelihood of surviving by even counting for the risk of HIV infection. So there are a number of trials that have been initiated to try to see if various kinds of drug regimens can prevent transmission in a breastfeeding population. Now, these two, in my view, would be unethical according to the Declaration of Helsinki because the state of the art is to give bottle feeding. So you would have to have a bottle feeding, at least a bottle feeding group, and you know that any alternative in your trial, that is, and any alternative is inferior to that. So you design a trial where you knowingly provide your participants with an inferior treatment. But you do it again in order to obtain results that can be useful in that setting. So these kind of examples, to me at least, demonstrate that you need to have an exception to the rule in the Declaration of Helsinki. And these are, in my view, the appropriate rules that we should adopt for allowing an exception. One is, the condition first is, the results of the trial will be relevant to the study population of the country which the studies is carried out, or you may want to have a stronger condition here. There's a reasonable likelihood that the new intervention will be implemented, so one or the two, one is stronger than the other. And the second condition, there is an and then, no alternative designs are possible for scientific reasons to get results that you need in that particular setting. And three, participants are not denied any treatment that they would get outside the research context. So they're not made worse off by being in the research project. These are the three conditions. And you can think about how this relates to the argument by Alan in the previous presentation, especially this third condition, because I think that's a fundamental condition that you have to show that you're not making people worse off than they would be outside your trial. I'll come back to this when I give you a further example, but I would like to go over to the second topic, and that is responsiveness requirement, because I think these are related, these two topics, because one of the conditions with regard to standard of care is that the research is responsive to the health needs of the country. The intervention is going to be useful for the country in which it is carried out. So here is the current version of the responsiveness requirement in the Declaration of Helsinki. Medical research involving a disadvantaged or vulnerable population or community is only justified. I mean, and there are problems that SEMA pointed out with the wording here, but we won't worry about that now. We're sort of getting at the main idea behind this particular principle. If the research is responsive to the health needs and priorities of this population or community, and if there's a reasonable likelihood that this population or community stands to benefit from the results of the research. So what I take this to mean is that there is a requirement that resource and resource-poor settings in developing countries should only be conducted if the results of the research, that is, the results of the research, that is, either the product developed or the knowledge that you get from that is useful in that particular setting. I think this is what the Declaration of Helsinki says, and a number of other guidelines say the same thing. So it's only if you can show that the actual results of the research is in some sense useful for that particular country, and the results are either the product that you develop, the drug or the intervention, or in general the knowledge that you gain from that. So phase one trials could also be justified by this particular criterion. I think that's also problematic. It's somewhat restrictive, and I will give you some examples, I think, illustrating why this is problematic, that you will limit it that much. I think we should allow it should be a broader requirement, allow for some exceptions in this particular case. And this has then been, the main argument, and I will not go with a theoretical argument for that, is that one should construe benefits. I mean, there are other types of benefits of clinical research, not just the results of the research, the product or the knowledge. So there is benefit of getting access to research interventions. People in the trial may benefit because they get access to a new intervention. There is benefit provided by the personnel involved in the research or providing other types of care, ancillary care, to the trial participants and the communities. We'll see examples of that in a moment. There is a benefits of infrastructure development, research capacity building. That's also a benefit of research. So we shouldn't narrow, and that's a general argument, we shouldn't narrow it only to the benefits in terms of the products developed or the knowledge gained. Now, I also disagree, even though I was part of developing the fair benefits framework, that may be an inadequate conceptualization of the kind of conditions that one should have for appropriate research. But the fundamental point that I still agree with regard to the fair benefits framework, not necessarily the details of that, but that we need to expand the notion of benefits. So that's the point I still agree with, and I think we should accept that, not necessarily the specific conditions that are mentioned in that particular framework. So what I want to do now is give you a number of examples that illustrate, at least make plausible, the justification for why we would want to loosen up the requirement in terms of what benefits we should count. And I will go through the examples one by one, and some of them you have heard already. And then I will give you four fundamental points of how to structure the discussion of these particular examples. So I will go through the examples first, and then I will try to give some systematic analysis of them. And these are all real examples. This is a trial that went on that was proposed a number of years ago when the new antiretroviral drugs were being started to be tested, combination therapies. We had AZT, one drug, and then various types of combinations were being introduced. A number of trials were being carried out. So the pharmaceutical company had a particular combination they wanted to test out. They proposed to do this in South Africa. And the reason for that was mainly that they could get treatment-naive patients in South Africa. Because people who were in the UK, in Europe, and in the United States had been already taking part in a number of trials and had been receiving various kinds of treatments. So they could go to South Africa and get access to people who hadn't been in trials before. And this was a new drug combination that they wanted to test out, one of their own drugs and then a rival drug company's drug. The Essex Review Committee at Wits University said that you can only do this trial in South Africa if you promise that those in the trial who benefit from this particular trial will get access to the drug after the trial is completed. So this is the requirement of post-trial access. And you can construe this as a general responsiveness requirement, that there has to be some responsive to the health needs, so kind of getting their population on treatment. When the pharmaceutical company heard that was a condition, they said, no, we don't want to do the trial in your country. This would give us decades of obligation afterwards to be in the business of providing treatment for patients. That's unacceptable to us. Other people have a responsibility to do that. Not us. We are have a responsibility to develop new effective intervention, not providing treatment. Essex Committee said they had their position, you can't do it. And as the question was asked earlier, when the Essex Committee makes that judgment, they effectively stop research. I mean, you need Essex approval before the research starts. If they say no, you can't do the research in that that country. That's quite clear. When the South African AIDS activist community hears about that decision, and this is what actually happened, they protest. They say, we would like you to approve this trial. We don't have access to HIV drugs in South Africa because of government policy, partly. I mean, you know the discussion in terms of HIV denialists and so on. They don't believe in HIV treatment, also because of lack of money. In an ideal world, of course, they say we would have access to antiretroviral treatment, but right now we don't. This is a way for at least some of us to get access for some time to antiretroviral drugs. That's why we would like you to approve this trial. Here you have the benefits that you get from being in the research of getting treatment, but the sort of wider use of the drug for the community is not the type of benefit that we're discussing. So if you only say that you can't count that benefit, you shouldn't approve the trial. But if you say that we can disregard the benefits to the community and concentrate on the benefits to individuals, you may want to approve the trial. So here you have the activist community against the Ethics Review Committee, and the question asked is, what do you do in this kind of circumstance? So I'll leave it at that, and we can come back to it later on. The second trial has a similar structure where you have a disagreement between two groups. And it's also a trial where the intervention is not of use to the community in which it is carried out. So the product of the trial is not useful for that particular community. This is a trial of Malarone for prevention purposes. Malarone is an anti-malaria drug, was developed as effective for treatment of malaria and was approved for that purpose. For the company, that is not very useful in terms of getting their research and development costs back, because all the patients who need treatment for malaria are in poor countries and they don't have any money to pay for the drug for treatment purposes. So they had a donation program to East Africa, mainly giving away the drug for free. That was controversial for other reasons, but they couldn't really make any money on the drug if you only could use it for treatment purposes. But if it could be demonstrated that a drug actually could also be used for prevention of malaria, then suddenly you had a huge market. All the people who travel from here to malaria endemic regions would pay a lot of money to have an effective and safe malaria prevention regimen, because the existing prevention drugs had quite a number of side effects and were unsatisfactory, and the company knew this. Armies of various countries who are stationed in malaria endemic regions would also buy this and pay huge amounts of money to prevent malaria. So they propose to see if we can see if Malarone works for prevention of malaria. And they proposed three trials and carried out three trials in three African countries. And this is the fourth trial that was done in Indonesia. And this is done on an island where there is malaria. There isn't malaria everywhere, in a malaria endemic region in Indonesia. What they propose to do is to take the population, give them a radical malaria cure, so give them Malarone, make sure that all the parasites are out of the people. Then you give half of them, half of the group Malarone, and half of them placebo. And then you watch and see how many malaria cases develop in the two groups, and you see if Malarone is effective in preventing of malaria in that region. Now, you could do it in travelers, of course. You could design a study where you gave it to people who were going from here to malaria endemic region, but that would be a logistical nightmare to have to follow people, and it would be very difficult. You couldn't do a placebo-controlled trial. You'd have to, on existing malaria prevention drugs, we need a huge trial in order to show effect. So that's the reason why they want to do it there. It's also clear that this is of absolutely no use to people living in malaria endemic regions, because you know that if you live in a malaria endemic regions, you are not on malaria prophylaxis unless you belong to specific groups. But you're not on general prophylaxis against malaria. You build up immunity, and that's how you prevent malaria and malaria endemic regions. So this is a case where you know the product is not going to be useful in that particular setting. When it goes to the Ethics Review Committee in Jakarta in this particular case, the Ethics Review Committee refuses to approve the trial. Say, we can't allow you to do this trial because it's not responsive to the health needs of this particular community. This drug is not useful for prevention purposes, and that's why we don't want to approve the trial. And this is what they should do according to the Declaration of Helsinki, of course. This is what is required of them if they follow the Declaration of Helsinki. When, again, the similar thing happened here, when the local community hears this, they call up the chair of the Ethics Review Committee and say, we want you to approve this trial. We live in an economically deprived area of Indonesia. We don't have access to health care here. It's okay for you to sit in Jakarta, where you have lots of good medical care, and disapprove this trial, but you don't understand the circumstances that we are faced with here. These are researchers who have been here, have done trials for a number of years. We know them. We trust them. They provide medical care not only to the participants, but to the general community. They provide malaria care, people who get malaria, inside and outside of the trial. If you don't approve this trial, some people will die as a result of your action. That is why we want you to approve this particular trial. So again, you have this conflict here between what the Ethics Review Committee says and what the local community says. And the question is, what should we do in this particular case? Should we allow these kinds of benefits, access to care, that the local community receive, override the fact that this is not going to be a useful product for the country, for the region in which it is carried out? Let me also say that there is no reason to believe that people in the trial are going to be harmed. If you know malaria, you know that it is it's not a dangerous disease if you get prompt treatment. So what they will do is they will have an on-site medical team. They will have procedure for immediately getting a malaria smear if somebody develops malaria symptoms, and that person will be treated immediately. If there are complications of malaria, there will be, even be a mechanism of transport to a tertiary care hospital. So there's no reason to believe that anybody would be harmed as a result of being in this particular trial. Again, you see the conflict here between the two types of benefits. The benefit in terms of the product developed is not there in this case, but there is are clear benefits in terms of the care provided as part of the research in this particular trial. The blood pressure trial in India, Seema mentioned already. There are no benefits to the country here. The point here, and Alan also made that, there are people who are in the trial benefit from the fact that they are getting access to state-of-the-art blood pressure intervention. I will not further discuss this particular case. Next one is a different type of benefit. We've talked now about benefits of access to care in trial. This shows that there is also a different type of benefit that may actually be important as well. This is the Havrik's trial in Thailand. This is hepatitis A vaccine trial that was also actually carried out in Thailand. Hepatitis A is a disease it occurs in the United States, of course, in a resource-rich setting. It's a major problem for soldiers. But it also occurs in a country such as Thailand among children or young adolescents. And it's a relatively mild disease. It's not a very serious problem. It's less of a problem in children than in adults. So it's not a major health problem for Thailand, even though it's about 20% of the children get hepatitis A. It's not something you would call, given the level of economic development, et cetera, for Thailand a health priority. There are other things that are more urgent in terms of health needs. But there's clearly a benefit in terms of treating preventing hepatitis A in a Thai setting, but it's not an urgent, it's not something you would give priority to if you had a choice. It could be done in the United States, and a number of trials were done in North America among high-risk population in institutional settings in particular. So it's not impossible to do the research here. But it is relatively easy because you have access to a number of children, a large number of people, in order to show effect of a vaccine such as this one. It's also clear that the main beneficiary of a vaccine such as this one will not be the Thai people. There's a theoretical possibility they could benefit from, but you wouldn't really envisage a max vaccination problem of the Thai population, given the cost of this particular vaccine and given the fact that it is not a major health problem. So the main beneficiary of this is the military and travelers, such as you and I, when we go from here to places where you are at risk of hepatitis A. So it was done, it was carried out, and as a result of this trial, Havrik's, the vaccine against hepatitis A, was licensed based on this, partly based on this trial. Again, the trial would violate the requirement that you can only justify a trial if the product developed is going to be useful for that country. It clearly violates that principle. However, and I will now sort of construct a justification for it. Now, it may not be true. There are some empirical facts here that are difficult to ascertain because it was controversial. Some people in Thailand argued against it, and other people argued in favor of this particular trial. Those who argued in favor of the trial, you can reconstruct their argument in the following way. They argued as follows. We know this is not a high priority for the Thai population. We would not really choose this if we had a choice. What is a problem for us is dengue. If you saw New York Times yesterday, there was a description of the dengue vaccine program. That is a high priority. We urgently need a dengue vaccine in Thailand. However, right now, this is 10, 15 years ago, there is no good dengue vaccine candidate right now. However, what we need is infrastructure and competence to do vaccine trials in Thailand so that when a good candidate comes along for dengue vaccine, then we have that and we can start that trial, which we really would want to do. And this trial is a way for us to build that infrastructure, get the competence to conduct vaccine trials, build the infrastructure to build to get vaccine trials done. That, I think, is at least a plausible justification for saying that maybe, if that is true, one could also approve this particular trial, in spite of the fact that the product is not particularly interesting for the population in which it is carried out. So vaccine trial that Alan discussed. I mean, you know the details now. New surfactant with the placebo. There is existing state-of-the-art treatments. You do it in South American countries. Two conditions are violated here. There is a standard of care that the people in the trial do not receive. So that's one standard of care condition. And the results, given the fact that this is going to be expensive, is not going to be useful for the country. So this trial violates both of these conditions. But those who argue in favor, I would say, look, you are harming the individuals in the trial if you don't approve, the trial. Some people get access to this surfactant if you approve the trial, and that's why you should approve it. I think when you take these cases, in order to think about them in a systematic way, I think there are four questions that one should ask about the research. And depending on the answers to these questions, one should either approve or disapprove the trial. And this is my proposal then for thinking about these kind of cases. First question is this trial part of a strategy to improve research capacity in the country? Yes or no? And of course, there are degrees here in terms of whether it's to high degree or low degree, one can make this more sophisticated. But this is the basic question. Will this in some way, because of the research itself, benefit the country in terms of the research infrastructure capacity, et cetera? I think that's a relevant question. Second question is the traditional one that is being mentioned as the only criterion that one should need to be concerned with. Is the product developed or the knowledge gain of use for that country? Yes or no? Again, to degrees, of course, when you want to make a sophisticated analysis. Third question is, do participants receive state-of-the-art interventions or not? That's the third question. And the fourth question is, are the participants better off than non-participants, people outside the trial, in terms of the intervention that they get as part of the study, or in terms of the additional care provided during the trial? So these, I think, are the four relevant questions we'll need to ask for every single trial. In the uncomplicated case, if you answer yes to all of these questions, it's not problematic. You approve the trial. If there is yes to all of these, I don't think anybody disagrees. I mean, all the relevant other things that we always look at for clinical research would also have to be fulfilled. But in terms of the things we're discussing now, if you answer yes to all of these, there's no problem. If you answer no to all of the questions, I think it's also quite clear in my view that you should not approve the trial. Especially the last one. If you make people worse off than they are outside the research context, I think it would be, in my view, impossible to approve the trial. So if you answer no to all of the questions, I think that you should not approve the trial. The interesting thing now is, if you answer yes to some and no to some others, how should you then think about the trial? Because I think the examples that I've given you is of precisely that nature. And in particular, is it the case that the only question you need to answer yes to is, are the participants better off than non-participants? Some would argue for that position. As long as you answer yes to that question, then you can approve the trial. I don't agree with that position. I think you need to answer yes to some of the other questions as well. But some have taken that position and argued for that. And I think this sort of way of thinking about it will enable you to identify where you are in terms of what you feel about these kinds of issues. So that's the one extreme. And the other extreme is that you need to answer yes to question four and question three, question two, three, and four. I mean, you need to answer yes to all of those in order to approve a trial. That's the Declaration of Helsinki. You need to show that the product developed is useful, people need to receive state-of-the-art interventions, and people need to be better off in the trial. So that's the other extreme position. My argument is that you can say yes to question one, but you can say no to question two and still approve the trial. Let me give you now the examples that I have discussed, some of them, and see how this would be in terms of these four questions. Is the trial part of a strategy to improve the research capacity of the country, assuming now the empirical facts are as I described? Yes. Is the product developed or knowledge gained useful for that country? No. Do participants receive state-of-the-art intervention? Yes, in this particular case. Are participants better off? Yes and yes. I think a trial such as this one can be approved if you have this type of answers to these questions. It would be prohibited by the other extreme view, which says that it is a necessary condition to have a yes to answer to question two. The surfactant trial. Is a trial part of a strategy to improve research capacity in the country? No. We assume now certain facts. I mean, just let me, if you assume that this is the case. Is a product developed? No. Do participants receive state-of-the-art interventions? No. Are they better off? Yes. I think this violates the conditions that I just gave you for doing trials where the participants receive less of the state-of-the-art care. And if that is the case, my argument is that you need to answer yes to question two. Now, you may disagree with that, but I think this is just a way of structuring it, and you can think about it in terms of how you would answer these same questions. The Malinon trial is a part of a strategy to improve research capacity. Let's assume no for that. Is the product developed? Gennady, no. Do they receive state-of-the-art intervention? Yes. And are they better off? Yes. I think a trial such as this one can also be approved if you have these kinds of answers. Thank you very much.
Questions?
Okay, I may be missing something here, but isn't the whole point of research that we're trying to find out whether these interventions are beneficial? So then how can we constantly assume that it's questions of are participants better off than non-participants, or does the intervention benefit the participants, is a question that we can just straightforwardly answer in the affirmative.
Yeah.
Before you answer that question, can I just say, because people are leaving, make sure you read the case study for next week, because we're going to discuss it, and it's on your CD. So I just saw people leaving. Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt the flow, but don't forget to read it.
No, but that's a good question, and it goes to the question of how we should think of risks and benefits in a particular trial. I can only give you a short answer to that question because I actually because it is a very complicated one. So first, sometimes you give interventions during the trial, it's not necessarily part of the trial design. So you give additional care and so on as part of the research context. So clearly then you can talk about benefits. So the interesting case is if you talk about the benefits of the interventions that you provide. Now the standard view is that when you have a drug in a phase 3 trial, there is a case to be made when a product is developed to that stage that you can argue that it is likely that the individuals will benefit from being in that kind of research. If you look at all the discussions of equipoise of clinical trial, not equipoise because that's the theoretical problem, but they assume that you can. So I have assumed that here. And a case can be made if you look at the data in terms of when a product enters into a phase 3 trial, the likelihood that that would be found effective is much greater than 50%. So that if you take that, you can make a case that there is likely benefit for those who take part in that particular trial. But if you take the notion of equipoise seriously, then you are actually saying you shouldn't think of individual benefit in these kinds of cases. So there is a potential conflict here between the sort of accepted notion of equipoise on the one hand and the fact that we at the same time talk about benefits to individuals. And I think that's a real conflict. And I happen to think that the notion of equipoise is the wrong notion here, and we actually can speak about benefits to individuals in trials.
So, Ryder, I wanted to push on the same issue, sort of, because it sounded like from your description that the last question there is sort of a threshold question almost,
yes.
That if the answer to that is no, then you don't even necessarily bother with the other three questions. But as I read the last question, there are two parts to it, and they can be pulled apart.
Yes.
So what do you? How would you deal with that?
Yes.
If one was, let's say, in terms of the interventions provided as part of the study, the answer is no, but there's additional care provided.
Yes. No, I mean, that's a very good question because, I mean, I think you should, what you want to avoid is you have a dangerous drug that you test out and you add on clinical benefit to compensate for that harm. So, I mean, if you want to make this more detailed, you have to exclude that possibility there. But what I wanted to have these two is to show that you may have a neutral in terms of the scientific design, that may be neutral in terms of there is no additional benefit to that. And then you have additional clinical benefits that you provide actually making it a positive benefit. So that's the situation I would like to allow.
Right.
And I think that's a generally accepted view that you can't just have, it can't have a harmful, but you can also make it more sophisticated. I mean, you can have a slight harm here and you can add on benefits. So I want to make sure that we think about that, but I do want to avoid a situation where you have serious harm with the intervention that you provide for scientific reasons and then just add on clinical benefit to justify that harm, to make it a net benefit.
I'm curious as to how questions one and two, which relate to two of your examples, where the people with the illnesses lobbied against the decision of the ethics board. How does one philosophically add benefit to the country, which is a political state, when we're asking individuals in research to make decisions about personal risk so that, questions three and four, clearly you're identifying, is it of benefit to the individual?
Yes.
But how do you admix that with, is it of benefit to the political state I happen to live in at the time
No, I think, that's is also an excellent question, because what I want this to be is not the individual who should decide whether they should participate based on these questions. This is a policy question. Should we allow this research to take place here in this setting? This is the kind of thing that a funding body would decide. This is the kind of thing that the regulatory agencies would decide. This is the kind of thing that an ethics review committee would decide. That's the level at which these questions should be asked. And they should ask these questions. And they are, have a duty to ask these questions and do, in fact, ask these questions and do, in fact, need these kinds of answers. And these are the kinds of questions we ask all the time when we decide to fund research, when we decide to approve a drug, and so on.
Just as a follow-up, so you gave two examples where affected groups then lobbied very...
Yes.
Okay, and we had that example in the United States. The United States had overturned the government policy, and we began HIV/AIDS research with lots of money.
Yes.
What happened in these countries where these groups lobbied to have the decision overturned?
No. In the case they were approved, these trials, the Ethics Committee reconsidered their position. But I think the Ethics Review Committee has a right to disregard the arguments that come from the community. It's not automatic, in my view, that whatever the community says should be accepted. For example, in the Malaron case, you had actually discussion going on between the Ethics Review Committee and the local community. The Ethics Review Committee said, well, we are sympathetic to your argument. I think you should get some additional benefits than what is currently provided to you. It's not just enough to get the medical care. You should get some additional benefits. company is profiting quite, is going potentially to profit quite a bit, and they could do some more. Do you, is there anything else that you would want to have? Now, and this is, sounds funny, but this was actually the answer that they gave, because these were transmigrants from Java to this other island. So they said, all of us, what we want to have is a paid vacation to go to back to Jakarta for a couple of weeks. Now, that, yes, I mean, while we don't think really that is the appropriate type of benefit that the company should provide, we should have something more permanent, something that's more health-related. And then they said, well, we have a problem with clean drinking water. So if they could dig a deep well for us, that would be something that would be quite useful. And that's what they agreed to. So here you see the Essex Review Committee didn't simply accept at face value whatever the community says we will adopt. They did go into negotiation and they did come to some kind of agreement.
But, I mean, that's what I find bizarre. I see this as a paternalism in Jakarta. You know, you don't know on this small island what's best for you. We'll decide. And it strikes me that you know, now they're negotiating for extra benefits based on you know, coming back and asking the question, well, we think we can get more out of the company for you. I mean, how is that any longer an ethics board which is deciding risk versus benefit to the individual?
Well, I
see this international process as being distinct. We would never ask an IRB in this country, for example, go negotiate with X for more for, you know, the community in Pennsylvania that we're...
Well, there are I'm not so worried about paternalism. I think there are lots of policies we have that are paternalistic. Drug approval processes, for example, where the drug regulatory agencies say that this is the benefits and harms are appropriate, and they decide that this drug should be approved but not the other drug, even though individuals may want to get access to that. So in principle, I have nothing against this type of paternalism. Second, I think IRBs and the Ethics Review Committees do, in principles, actually make these kinds of decisions. They are supposed to evaluate the value, the social value of a study, whether it's a useful study or not. And they have that right to do so and could, in principle, then disapprove a study on that basis. Thirdly, there are, in most regulations, a specific requirement that Ethics Review, which is rarely used but is there, that Ethics Review Committees have to make sure that the research conforms to generally accepted values in the community. So if there is a generally accepted value in the community that research should be responsive to the health needs, they have the power to evaluate the research for that particular, according to that particular criterion.
I just wanted to ask the last question, in tying this with what Alan was talking about. Would you call this trial, for example, a permissible example of mutually advantageous consensual exploitation?
I'm not sure if... what Alan talks about when he talks about, there's mutual advantage here. I mean, that's quite clear. Whether it's exploitation, that's the other question. Whether this is an unfair transaction, I'm not sure about that. Because then you would need an account of fairness.
It's just interesting that the Ethics Committee thought maybe it was unfair, but the community said, you know, even if you think it's unfair, come exploit us,
yeah,
or whatever.
Well, if you look at this particular trial, if you talk to people in the region and that when it's discussed, you will find that many people would still disagree with this, saying it was inappropriate, and it's not clear. I mean, I've described it in a certain way that makes it more compelling that it may be. But there are a number of empirical facts here that you need to consider, other things you need to consider. And when you have a more extended discussion, typically you will see about 50% agreeing with it and 50% disagreeing with this particular trial. I mean, the Essex Committee happened to change their mind. And people do see that they're pulled in different directions. And people do see the dilemma here. And they see that there is a case to be made for approving this trial. I mean, I think, and that's the main point that I want to make. I don't say automatically you should approve this trial or disapprove it. There is a case to be made for this, but the current guidelines would automatically prohibit it, and I think that's wrong.
Okay. Thank you. Again, next week is the last week, and we have a session discussing a case study. The case study is on your CD. please read it and come prepared to discuss it.